to stay away? Then why leave bodies in the first place? She tugged at the end of her braid, stopping in front of a clothier's window. Simple, well-cut dresses stood on display, not at all like the elegant, intricate fashions in Rifthold. She noticed the wide-eyed, pale shopkeeper a heartbeat before the woman slashed the curtains shut. Well, then. Rowan snorted, and Selena turned to him. You're used to this, I assume?
A lot of the Fae who venture into mortal lands have earned themselves a reputation for taking what they want. It went unchecked for too many years. But even though our laws are stricter now, the fear remains.
A criticism of Maeve? Who enforces these laws? A dark smile.
I do. When I'm not off campaigning, my aunt has me hunt down the rogues.
And kill them? The smile remained.
If the situation calls for it. Or I just haul them back to Doranel and let Maeve decide what to do with them.
I think I'd prefer death at your hands to death at Maeve's.
That might be the first wise thing you've said to me.
The Demi-Fae said you have 5 other warrior friends. Do they hunt with you? How often do you see them?
I see them whenever the situation calls for it. Maeve has them serve her as she sees fit, as she does with me.
Every word was clipped.
It is an honor to be a warrior serving in her inner circle.
Selena hadn't suggested otherwise, but she wondered why he felt the need to add it. The street around them was empty. Even food carts had been abandoned. She took a long breath, sniffing, and... Was that chocolate? Did you bring any money?
A hesitant lift of his brow. Yes. They won't take your bribes, though.
Good. More for me, then. She pointed out the pretty sign swaying in the sea breeze. Confectionery. If we can't win them with charm, we might as well win them with our business.
Did you somehow not hear what I just...
But she had already reached the shop, which smelled divine and was stocked with chocolates and candies and, oh gods, hazelnut truffles. Even though the confectioner blanched as the two of them overpowered the space, Selena gave the woman her best smile.
Over her rotting corpse was she letting these people get away with shutting curtains in her face, or letting them think that she was here to plunder.
Nehemia had never once let the preening, bigoted idiots in Rifthold shut her out of any store, dining room, or household. And she had the sense that her friend might have been proud of the way she went from shop to shop that afternoon, head held high, and charmed the ever-loving hell out of those villagers. Once word spread that the two fae strangers were spending silver on chocolates, then a few books, then some fresh bread and meat, the streets filled again. Vendors bearing everything from apples to spices to pocket watches were suddenly eager to chat, so long as they sold something. When Selena popped into the cramped messenger's guild to mail a letter, she managed to ask a few novices if they'd been hired by anyone of interest. They hadn't, but she still tipped them handsomely. Rowan dutifully carried every bag and box Selena bought, save the chocolates, which she ate as she strolled around, one after another after another. When she offered one to him, he claimed he didn't eat sweets. Ever. Not surprising. The villagers wound up not knowing anything, which she supposed was good, because it meant that they hadn't been lying. But the crabmonger did say he'd found a few discarded knives, small, sharp-as-death knives, in his nets recently. He tossed them all back into the water as gifts for the sea god. The creature had sucked these people dry, not cut them up. So it was likely that Wendlinite soldiers had somehow lost a trunk of their blades in some storm. At sunset, the innkeeper even approached them about a suddenly vacant suite. The very best suite in town, he claimed. but Selena was starting to wonder whether they might attract the wrong sort of attention, and she wasn't particularly in the mood to see Rowan disembowel a would-be thief. So she politely refused, and they set out down the street, the light turning thick and golden as they entered the forest once more. Not a bad day, she realized, as she nodded off under the forest canopy. Not bad at all. Her mother had called her Fireheart. But to her court, to her people, she would one day be queen. To them, she was the heir to two mighty bloodlines, and to a tremendous power that would keep them safe and raise their kingdom to even greater heights. A power that was a gift. Or a weapon. That had been the near constant debate for the first 8 years of her life. As she grew older, and it became apparent that while she'd inherited most of her mother's looks, she'd received her father's volatile temper and wildness, the wary questions became more frequent, asked by rulers in kingdoms far from their own. And on days like this, she knew that everyone would hear of the event, for better or worse. She was supposed to be asleep, and was wearing her favorite silk nightgown, her parents having tucked her in minutes ago. Though they had told her they weren't, she knew they were exhausted and frustrated. She'd seen the way the court was acting, and how her uncle had put a gentle hand on her father's shoulder and told him to take her up to bed. But she couldn't sleep, not when her door was cracked open, and she could hear her parents from their bedroom in the suite they shared in the upper levels of the White Castle. They thought they were speaking quietly, but it was with an immortal's ears that she listened in the near dark.
I don't know what you expect me to do, Evelyn, her father said.
She could almost hear him prowling before the giant bed on which she had been born.
What's done is done.
Tell them it was exaggerated. Tell them the librarians were making a fuss over nothing, her mother hissed. Start a rumor that someone else did it, trying to pin the blame on her.
This is all because of Maeve.
This is because she is going to be hunted, Ro, for her whole life. Maeve and others will hunt her for this power.
And you think agreeing to let those little bastards ban her from the library will prevent that? Tell me, why does our daughter love reading so much?
That has nothing to do with it.
Tell me.
When her mother didn't respond, her father growled.
She is 8. And she has told me that her dearest friends are characters in books.
She has Adian.
She has Adian because he is the only child in this castle who isn't petrified of her, who hasn't been kept away because we have been lax with her training. She needs training, Ev. Training and friends. If she doesn't have either, that's when she'll turn into what they're afraid of.
Silence. And then, a huff from beside her bed.
I'm not a child,
Adian hissed from where he sat in a chair, arms crossed. He'd slipped in here after her parents had left, to talk quietly to her, as he often did when she was upset.
And I don't see why it's a bad thing if I'm your only friend. Quiet, she hissed back.
Though Adian couldn't shift, his mixed blood allowed him to hear with uncanny range and accuracy, better even than hers. And though he was 5 years older, he was her only friend. She loved her court, yes, loved the adults who pampered and coddled her. But the few children who lived in the castle kept away, despite their parents' urging. Like dogs, she'd sometimes thought. The others could smell her differences.
She needs friends her age, her father went on. Maybe we should send her to school. Cal and Marion have been talking about sending a lead next year.
No schools, and certainly not that so-called magic school, when it's so close to the border, and we don't know what Otterlin is planning.
Adian loosed a breath, his legs propped on the mattress. His tan face was angled toward the cracked door, his golden hair shining faintly. But there was a crease between his brows. Neither of them took well to being separated, and the last time one of the castle boys had teased him for it, Adian had spent a month shoveling horse dung for beating the boy into a pulp. Her father sighed.
Ev, don't kill me for this, but you're not making this easy. For us or for her.
Her mother was quiet, and she heard a rustle of clothing and a murmur of, I know, before her parents started speaking too quietly for even her fey ears. Adian growled again, his eyes, their matching eyes, gleaming in the dark.
I don't see what all the fuss is about. So what if you burned a few books? Those librarians deserve it. When we're older, maybe we'll burn it to the ground together.
She knew he meant it. He'd burn the library, the city, or the whole world to ashes if she asked him. It was their bond, marked by blood and scent and something else she couldn't place. A tether as strong as the one that bound her to her parents. Stronger, in some ways. She didn't answer him, not because she didn't have a reply, but because the door groaned, and before Adian could hide, her bedroom flooded with light from the foyer. Her mother crossed her arms. Her father, however, let out a soft laugh, his brown hair illuminated by the hall light, his face in shadow.
Typical,
he said, stepping aside to clear a space for Adian to leave.
Don't you have to be up at dawn to train with Quinn? You were 5 minutes late this morning. 2 days in a row will earn you a week on stable duty. Again.
In a flash, Adian was on his feet and gone. Alone with her parents, she wished she could pretend to sleep. But she said,
I don't want to go away to school.
Her father walked to her bed, every inch the warrior Adian aspired to be. A warrior prince, she heard people call him, who would one day make a mighty king. She sometimes thought her father had no interest in being king, especially on days when he took her up into the Staghorns and let her wander through Oakwald in search of the Lord of the Forest. He never seemed happier than at those times, and always seemed a little sad to go back to Orinth.
You're not going away to school, he said,
looking over his broad shoulder at her mother, who lingered by the doorway, her face still in shadow.
But do you understand why the librarians acted the way they did today?
Of course she did. She felt horrible for burning the books. It had been an accident, and she knew her father believed her. She nodded and said,
I'm sorry.
You have nothing to be sorry for,
her father said, a growl in his voice.
I wish I was like the others, she said.
Her mother remained silent, unmoving, but her father gripped her hand.
I know, love. But even if you were not gifted, you would still be our daughter. You would still be a Galathinius and their queen one day.
I don't want to be queen!
Her father sighed. This was a conversation they'd had before. He stroked her hair.
I know, he said again. Sleep now. We'll talk about it in the morning.
They wouldn't, though. She knew they wouldn't, because she knew there was no escaping her fate, even though sometimes she prayed to the gods that she could. She lay down again nonetheless, letting him kiss her head and murmur goodnight. Her mother still said nothing, but as her father walked out, Evelyn remained, watching her for a long while.
just as she was drifting off. Her mother left. And as she turned, she could have sworn that tears gleamed on her pale face. Selena jolted awake, hardly able to move, to think. It had to be the smell of that god's damned body yesterday that had triggered the dream. It was agony seeing her parents' faces, seeing Adian. She blinked, focusing on her breathing, until she was no longer in that beautiful jewel box-like room, until the scent of the pine and snow on the northern wind had vanished, and she could see the morning mist weaving through the canopy of leaves above her. The cold, damp moss seeped through her clothes. The brine of the nearby sea hung thick in the air. She lifted her hand to examine the long scar carved on her palm.
"Do you want breakfast?"
Rowan asked, from where he crouched over unlit logs, the first fire she'd seen him assemble. She nodded, then rubbed her eyes with the heels of her palms.
"Then start the fire," he said.
"You can't be serious." He didn't deign to respond. Groaning, she rotated on her sleeping roll until she sat cross-legged facing the logs. She held a hand toward the wood.
"Pointing is a crutch. Your mind can direct the flames just fine."
"Perhaps I like the dramatics."
He gave her a look she interpreted to mean, "Light the fire, now." She rubbed her eyes again and concentrated on the logs.
"Easy,"
Rowan said.
And she wondered if that was approval in his voice, as the wood began to smoke.
"A knife, remember? You are in control."
A knife, carving out a small bit of magic. She could master this. Light one single fire. Gods, she was so heavy again. That stupid dream, memory, whatever it was, today would be an effort.
A pit yawned open inside her, the magic rupturing out before she could shout a warning. She incinerated the entire surrounding area.
When the smoke and flames cleared, thanks to Rowan's wind, he merely sighed.
"At least you didn't panic and shift back into your human form."
She supposed that was a compliment. The magic had felt like a release, a thrown punch. The pressure under her skin had lessened. So Selena just nodded. But shifting, it seemed, was to be the least of her problems. Chapter 29. It had just been a kiss, Sorsha told herself every day afterward. A quick, breathless kiss that had made the world spin. The iron in the treacle had worked, though it bothered Dorian enough that they started to toy with the dosage and ways to mask it. If he were caught ingesting powders at all hours of the day, it would lead to questions. So it became a daily contraceptive tonic, because no one would bat an eye at that, not with his reputation. Sorsha was still reassuring herself that the kiss had meant nothing more than a thank you as she reached the door to Dorian's tower room, his daily dose in hand. She knocked, and the prince called her inside. The assassin's hound was sprawled on his bed, and the prince himself was lounging on his shabby couch. He sat up, however, and smiled at her in that way of his. "I think I found a better combination. The mint might go down better than the sage," she said, holding up the glass of reddish liquid. He came toward her, but there was something in his gait, a kind of prowl that made her straighten. Especially as he set down the glass and stared at her, long and deep.
"What?"
she breathed, backing up a step. He gripped her hand, not hard enough to hurt, but enough to stop her retreat.
"You understand the risks, and yet you're still helping me," he said. "Why?"
"It's the right thing.
My father's laws say otherwise.
Her face heated. I don't know what you want me to say.
His hands were cool as he brushed her cheeks, his calluses scraping gently.
I just want to thank you,
he murmured, leaning in,
for seeing me and not running.
She was burning up from the inside out, and she pulled back, hard enough that he let go. Amethy was right, even if she was vicious. There were plenty of beautiful women here, and anything more than a flirtation would end poorly. He was crown prince, and she was nobody. She gestured to the goblet.
If it's not too much trouble, Your Highness.
He cringed at the title.
Send word about how this one works for you.
She didn't dare a by your leave or farewell or anything that would keep her in that room a moment longer. And he didn't try to stop her as she walked out and shut the door behind her. She leaned against the stone wall of the narrow landing, a hand on her thundering heart. It was the smart thing to do, the right thing to do. She had survived this long, and would only survive the road ahead if she continued to be unnoticed, reliable, quiet. But she didn't want to be unnoticed. Not with him. Not forever. He made her want to laugh and sing and shake the world with her voice. The door swung open, and she found him standing in the doorway, solemn and wary. Maybe there could be no future, no hope of anything more. But just looking at him standing there, in this moment, she wanted to be selfish and stupid and wild. It could all go to hell tomorrow, but she had to know what it was like, just for a little while, to belong to someone, to be wanted and cherished. He did not move, didn't do anything but stare, seeing her exactly how she saw him. As she grabbed the lapels of his tunic, pulled his face down to hers, and kissed him fiercely. Kaol had barely been able to concentrate for the past few days, thanks to the meeting he was moments away from having. It had taken longer than he had anticipated before Ren and Murtaugh were finally ready to meet him, their first encounter since that night in the slums. Kaol had to wait for his next night off. Adian had to find a secure location, and then they had to coordinate with the two lords from Terrasen. He and the general had left the castle separately, and Kaol had hated himself when he lied to his men about where he was going. Hated that they wished him fun. Hated that they trusted him, the man who was meeting with their mortal enemies. Kaol shoved those thoughts aside as he approached the dim alley a few blocks from the decrepit boarding house where they were to meet. Under his heavy hooded cloak, he was armed more heavily than he usually bothered. Every breath he took felt too shallow. A two-note whistle sounded down the alley, and he echoed it. Adian stalked through the low-lying mist coming off the aviary, his face concealed in the cowl of his own cloak. He wasn't wearing the sword of Orinth. Instead, an assortment of blades and fighting knives were strapped to the general. A man able to walk into hell itself and come out grinning.
Where are the others?
Kaol said softly. The slums were quiet tonight, too quiet for his liking. Dressed as he was, few would dare approach him. But the walk through the crooked and dark streets had been harrowing. Such poverty and despair, and desperation. It made people dangerous, willing to risk anything to scratch out another day of living. Adian leaned against the crumbling brick wall behind them. Don't get your undergarments in a twist. They'll be here soon.
I've waited long enough for this information.
What's the rush? Adian drawled, scanning the alley.
I'm leaving Rifthold in a few weeks to return to Aniel.
Adian didn't look directly at him, but he could feel the general staring at him from beneath his dark hood. So get out of it. Tell them you're busy.
I made a promise,
Kaol said.
I've already bargained for time, but I want to have done something for the prince before I leave.
The general turned to him then.
I'd heard you were estranged from your father.
Why the sudden change? It would have been easier to lie, but Kaol said,
My father is a powerful man. He has the ear of many influential members at court and is on the king's council.
Adian let out a low laugh.
I've butted heads with him in more than a few war councils.
That Kaol would have paid good money to see. But he wasn't smiling as he said,
It was the only way I could get her sent to Wendland.
He quickly explained the bargain he'd made, and when he was finished, Adian loosed a long breath.
Damn,
the general said,
then shook his head. I didn't think that kind of honor still existed in Otterlan.
He supposed it was a compliment, and a high one coming from Adian.
And what of your father?
Kaol said, if only to shift conversation away from the hole in his chest.
I know your mother was kin to her, but what of your father's line?
My mother never admitted who my father was, even when she was wasting away on her sickbed, Adian said flatly. I don't know if it was from shame, or because she couldn't even remember, or to protect me somehow. Once I was brought over here, I didn't really care. But I'd rather have no father than your father.
Kaol chuckled, and might have asked another question, had boots not scraped on stone at the other end of the alley, followed by a rasping breath.
That fast, Adian had palmed two fighting knives, and Kaol drew his own sword. A bland, nondescript blade he'd swiped from the barracks, as a man staggered into view. He had an arm wrapped around his middle, the other bracing himself against the brick wall of an abandoned building. Adian was instantly moving, knives sheathed again. It wasn't until Kaol heard him say,
Ren,
that he also hurried toward the young man. In the moonlight, the blood on Ren's tunic was a shining, deep stain.
Where is Murtaug?
Adian demanded, sliding an arm under Ren's shoulders.
Safe,
Ren panted, his face deathly pale. Kaol scanned either end of the alley.
We were followed, so we tried losing them.
He heard, more than saw, Ren's wince.
They cornered me.
How many?
Adian said softly, though Kaol could almost feel the violence simmering off the general.
Eight,
Ren said, and hissed in pain.
Killed two, then got free. They're following me.
Leaving six. If they were unharmed, they were probably close behind. Kaol examined the stones beyond Ren. The wound to his abdomen couldn't be deep if he'd managed to keep the blood flow from leaving a trail. But it still had to be agonizing, potentially fatal, if it had pierced the wrong spot. Adian went rigid, hearing something that Kaol couldn't. He quietly, gently passed the sagging Ren into Kaol's arms.
There are three barrels 10 paces away,
the general said with lethal calm as he faced the alley entrance.
Hide behind them and keep your mouths shut.
That was all Kaol needed to hear as he took Ren's weight and hauled him to the large barrels, then eased him onto the ground. Ren stifled a groan of pain, but kept still. There was a small crack between two of the barrels where Kaol could see the alley, and the six men who stalked into it almost shoulder to shoulder. He couldn't make out much more than dark tunics and cloaks. The men paused when they beheld Adian standing before them, still hooded. The general drew his fighting knives and purred,
None of you are leaving this alley alive.
They didn't. Kaol marveled at Adian's skill.
the speed and swiftness and utter confidence that made it like watching a brutal, unforgiving dance. It was over before it really started. The six assailants seemed at ease with weapons, but against a man with Fey blood surging in his veins, they were useless. No wonder Adian had risen to such high ranking so quickly. He'd never seen another man fight like that. Only Selena had come close. He couldn't tell which one of them would win if they were ever matched against each other. But together, Kaol's heart went cold at the thought. Six men dead in a matter of moments. Six. Adian wasn't smiling as he came back over to Kaol and dropped a scrap of fabric on the ground before them. Even Ren, panting through clenched teeth, looked. It was a black, heavy material, and emblazoned on it in dark thread, nearly invisible save for the glint of moonlight, was a wyvern. The royal sigil.
"I don't know these men,"
Kaol said, more to himself than to protest his innocence.
"I've never seen that uniform."
"From the sound of it," Adian said, that rage still simmering in his voice, as he cocked his head toward noises that Kaol could not hear with his human ears.
"There are more of them out there, and they're combing the slums door to door for Ren. We need a place to hide."
Ren held on to consciousness long enough to say,
"I know where."
Chapter 30 Kaol held his breath for the entire walk as he and Adian gripped the half-conscious Ren between them, the three of them swaying and staggering, looking for all the world like drunkards out for a night of thrills in the slums. The streets were still teeming despite the hour, and one of the women they passed slouched over and gripped Adian's tunic, spewing a slur of sultry words. But the general used a gentle hand to disengage her and said,
"I don't pay for what I can get for free."
Somehow it felt like a lie, since Kaol hadn't seen or heard of Adian sharing anyone's bed all these weeks. But perhaps knowing that Aelin was alive changed his priorities. They reached the opium den Ren had named in between spurts of unconsciousness, just as the shouts of soldiers storming into boarding houses, inns, and taverns echoed from down the street. Kaol didn't wait to see who they were and shoved through the carved wooden door. The reek of unwashed bodies, waste, and sweet smoke clotted in Kaol's nostrils. Even Adian coughed and gave Ren, who was almost a dead weight in their arms, a disapproving stare. But the aging madam swept forward to greet them, her long tunic and overrobe flowing on some phantom wind, and ushered them down the wood-paneled hallway, her feet soft on the worn, colorful rugs. She began prattling off prices and the night specials, but Kaol took one look in her green, cunning eyes and knew she was familiar with Ren, someone who had probably built herself her own empire here in Rifthold. She set them up in a veiled-off alcove littered with worn silk cushions that stank of sweet smoke and sweat, and after she lifted her brows at Kaol, he handed over 3 gold pieces. Ren groaned from where he was sprawled on the cushions between Adian and Kaol, but before Kaol could so much as say a word, the madam returned with a bundle in her arms.
"They are next door," she said,
her accent lovely and strange.
"Hurry."
She'd brought a tunic. Adian made quick work of stripping Ren, whose face was deathly pale, lips bloodless. The general swore as they beheld the wound, a slice low in his belly.
"Any deeper and his damn intestines would be hanging out," Adian said.
He took a strip of clean fabric from the madam and wrapped it around the young lord's muscled abdomen. There were scars all over Ren already. If he survived, this probably would not be the worst of them. The madam knelt before Kaol and opened the box in her hands. 3 pipes now lay on the low-lying table before them.
"You need to play the part," she breathed,
glancing over her shoulder through the thick black veil. no doubt calculating how much time they had left. Kaol didn't even try to object as she used rouge to redden the skin around his eyes, applied some paste and powder to leach the color from his face, shook free a few buttons on his tunic, and mussed his hair.
Lay back, limp and loose, and keep the pipe in your hand. Smoke it if you need to take the edge off.
That was all she told him before she got to work on Adian, who had finished stuffing Ren into his clean clothes. In moments, the three of them were reclined on the reeking cushions, and the madam had bustled off with Ren's bloody tunic. The lord's breathing was labored and uneven, and Kaol fought the shaking in his own hands as the front door banged open. The soft feet of the madam hurried past to greet the men. Though Kaol strained to hear, Adian seemed to be listening without a problem.
Five of you, then?
The madam chirped loudly enough for them to hear.
We're looking for a fugitive, was the growled response. Clear out of the way.
Surely you would like to rest. We have private rooms for groups, and you are all such big men.
Each word was purred, a sensual feast.
It is extra for bringing in swords and daggers. A liability, you see, when a drug takes you—
Woman, enough!
The man barked. Fabric ripped as each veiled alcove was inspected. Kaol's heart thundered, but he kept his body limp, even as he itched to reach for his blade.
Then I shall leave you to your work,
she said demurely. Between them, Ren was so dazed that he truly could have been drugged out of his mind. Kaol just hoped his own performance was convincing as the curtain ripped back.
Is that the wine?
Adian slurred, squinting at the men. His face wan and his lips set in a loose grin. He was hardly recognizable.
We've been waiting 20 minutes, you know.
Kaol smiled blearily up at the six men peering into the room.
All in those dark uniforms. All unfamiliar. Who the hell were they? Why had Ren been targeted?
Wine,
Adian snapped. A spoiled son of a merchant, perhaps.
Now.
The men just swore at them and continued on. 5 minutes later, they were gone. The den must have been a meeting point, because Murtaugh found them there an hour later. The madam had brought them to her private office, and they'd been forced to pin Ren to the worn couch as she, with surprising adeptness, disinfected, stitched, and bound up his nasty wound. He would survive, she said, but the blood loss and injury would keep him incapacitated for a while. Murtaugh paced the entire time, until Ren collapsed into a deep sleep, courtesy of some tonic the woman made him choke down. Kaol and Adian sat at the small table crammed in amongst the crates upon crates of opium stacked against the walls. He didn't want to know what was in the tonic Ren had ingested. Adian was watching the locked door, head cocked as if listening to the sounds of the den, as he said to Murtaugh,
Why were you being followed? And who were those men?
The old man kept pacing.
I don't know, but they knew where Ren and I would be. Ren has a network of informants throughout the city, and one of them could have betrayed us.
Adian's attention remained on the door, a hand on one of his fighting knives.
They wore uniforms with the royal sigil. Even the captain didn't recognize them. You need to lay low for a while.
Murtaugh's silence was too heavy. Kaol asked quietly,
Where do we bring him when he can be moved?
Murtaugh paused his pacing, his eyes full of grief.
There is no place. We have no home.
Adian looked sharply at him.
Where in the hell have you been staying all this time? Here and there, squatting in abandoned buildings. When we are able to take work, we stay in boarding houses. But these days...
They would not have access to the Alsbrook coffers, Kaol realized. Not if they had been in hiding for so many years. But to be homeless.
Adian's face was a mask of disinterest. And you have no place in Rifthold safe enough to hold him, to see his mending.
Not a question, but Murtagh nodded all the same. Adian examined Ren, sprawled on the dark sofa against the far wall. His throat bobbed once, but then he said,
"Tell the captain your theory about magic."
In the long hours that passed, as Ren regained his strength enough to be moved, Murtagh explained everything he knew. His entire story came out, the old man almost whispering at times, of the horrors they'd fled, and how Ren had gotten each and every scar. Kaol understood why the young man had been so close-lipped until now. Secrecy had kept them alive. Altogether, Murtagh and Ren had learned the various waves the day magic had vanished formed a rough triangle across the continent. The first line went from Rifthold to the Frozen Wastes. The second went down from the Frozen Wastes to the edge of the deserted peninsula. The third line went from there back to Rifthold. A spell, they believed, had been the cause of it. Standing around the map Adian had produced, the general traced a finger over the lines again and again, as if sorting out a battle strategy.
A spell sent from specific points, like a beacon.
Kaol thumped his knuckles on the table.
Is there some way of undoing it?
Murtagh sighed.
Our work was interrupted by the disturbance with Archer, and our sources vanished from the city for fear of their lives. But there has to be a way.
So where do we start looking? Adian asked.
There's no chance in hell the king would leave clues lying around.
Murtagh nodded.
We need eyewitnesses to confirm what we suspect. But the places we think the spell originated are occupied by the king's forces. We've been waiting for an inn.
Adian gave him a lazy grin. No wonder you kept telling Ren to be nice to me. As if in response, Ren groaned, struggling to rise to consciousness. Had the young lord ever felt safe or at peace at any point in the past 10 years? It would explain that anger. The reckless anger that coursed through all the young, shattered hearts of Terrasen, including Selena's. Kaol said,
There is an apartment hidden in a warehouse in the slums. It's secure and has all the amenities you need. You're welcome to stay there for however long you require.
He felt Adian watching him carefully. But Murtagh frowned.
However generous, I cannot accept the offer to stay in your house.
It's not my house, Kaol said. And believe me, the owner won't mind one bit.
Chapter 31 Eat it, Manon said, holding out the raw leg of mutton to Abraxos. The day was bright, but the wind off the snowy peaks of the Fangs still carried a brutal chill. They'd been going outside the mountain for little spurts to stretch his legs, using the back door that opened onto a narrow road leading into the mountains. She'd guided him by the giant chain, as if it would do anything to stop him from taking off, up a sharp incline, and then onto the meadow atop a plateau. Eat it, she said, shaking the freezing meat at Abraxos, who was now lying on his belly in the meadow, huffing at the first grasses and flowers to poke through the melting ice.
It's your reward, she said through her teeth.
You earned it.
Abraxos sniffed at a cluster of purple flowers, then flicked his eyes to her. No meat, he seemed to say.
It's good for you, she said.
And he went right back to sniffing the violets or whatever they were. If a plant wasn't good for poisoning or healing or keeping her alive if she were starving, she'd never bothered to learn its name, especially not wildflowers. She tossed the leg right in front of his massive mouth and tucked her hands into the folds of her red cloak. He snuffed at it, his new iron teeth glinting in the radiant light, then stretched out on one massive claw-tipped wing and shoved it aside. Manon rubbed her eyes. Is it not fresh enough? He moved to sniff some white and yellow flowers. A nightmare. This was a nightmare. You can't really like flowers. Again, those dark eyes shifted to her. Blinked once. I most certainly do, he seemed to say. She splayed her arms. You never even smelled a flower until yesterday. What's wrong with the meat now? He needed to eat tons and tons of meat to put on the muscle he was lacking. When he went back to sniffing the flowers rather delicately, the insufferable, useless worm, she stalked to the leg of mutton and hauled it up. If you won't eat it, she snarled at him, hoisting it up with both her hands to her mouth and popping her iron teeth down, then I will. Abraxos watched her with those bemused dark eyes as she bit into the icy raw meat and spat it everywhere. What in the mother's dark shadow? She sniffed at the meat. It wasn't rancid, but like the men here, it tasted off. The sheep were raised inside the mountain, so maybe it was something in the water. As soon as she got back, she'd give the 13 the order not to touch the men. Not until she knew what in hell was making them taste and smell that way. Regardless, Abraxos had to eat, because he had to get strong, so she could be wing leader. So she could see the look on Iskra's face when she ripped her apart at the war games. And if this was the only way to get the worm to eat... Fine, she said, chucking the leg away. You want fresh meat? She scanned the mountains towering around them, eyeing the gray stones. Then we're going to have to hunt. You smell like shit and blood. Her grandmother didn't turn from her desk, and Manon didn't flinch at the insult. She was covered in both, actually. It was thanks to Abraxos, the flower-loving worm, who had just watched while she scaled one of the nearby cliffs and brought down a braying mountain goat for him. Brought down was a more elegant phrase than what had actually happened. She half froze to death as she waited for some goats to pass on their treacherous climb. And then, when she'd finally ambushed one, she'd not only rolled in its dung as she'd grappled with it, but it had also dumped a fresh load on her, right before it went tumbling out of her arms and broke its skull on the rocks below. It had nearly taken her with it, but she'd managed to grab onto a dead root. Abraxos was still lying on his belly, sniffing the wildflowers, when she returned with the dead goat in her arms, its blood now iced on her cloak and tunic. He'd devoured the goat in two bites, then gone back to enjoying the wildflowers. At least he'd eaten. Getting him back to the Northern Fang, however, was a trial in itself. He hadn't hurt her, hadn't fled, but he'd pulled on the chains, shaking his head again and again as they neared the cavernous back door, where the sounds of the wyverns and men reached them. But he'd gone in, though he'd snapped and growled at the handlers who rushed out to retrieve him. For some reason, she hadn't been able to stop thinking about his reluctance, the way he'd looked at her with a mute plea. She didn't pity him, because she pitied nothing. But she couldn't stop thinking about it. You summoned me, said Manon, head high. I did not want to keep you waiting. You are keeping me waiting, Manon. The witch turned, eyes full of death and promises of endless pain. It has been weeks now, and you are not airborne with your 13. The Yellowlegs have been flying as a host for 3 days. 3 days, Manon. And you're coddling your beast. Manon didn't show one flicker of feeling. Apologizing would make it worse, as would excuses. Give me orders,
and they will be done. I want you airborne by tomorrow evening. Don't bother coming back if you aren't.
I hate you, Manon panted through her iron teeth, as she and Abraxos finished their grueling trek to the top of the mountain peak. It had taken half a day to get here, and if this didn't work, it would take until evening to get back to the Omega, to pack her belongings. Abraxos was curled up like a cat on the narrow stretch of flat rock atop the mountain. Willful, lazy worm. He didn't even blink at her. Take the eastern side, the overseer had said, as he'd helped her saddle up and set out from the back door of the northern fang before dawn. They used this peak to train the hatchling wyverns and reluctant flyers. The eastern side, Manon saw, as she peered over the lip she'd just climbed, was a smooth incline after a 20-foot drop. Abraxos could take a running start off the edge, try to glide, and if he fell, well, it would only be 20 feet, and then wind-smooth rock to slide down for a ways. Slim possibility for death. No, death lay on the western side. Frowning at Abraxos, who was licking his new iron claws, Manon crossed the plateau and, despite herself, winced at the blistering wind that shot up. To the west was an endless plunge through nothing until the spiked, unforgiving rocks below. It would take a crew of men to scrape off her remains. Eastern side it was. She checked her tight braid and flicked her clear inner lid into place. Let's go. Abraxos lifted his massive head as if to say, "We just got here." She pointed to the eastern edge. Flying. Now. He huffed, curling his back to her, the leather saddle gleaming. Oh, I don't think so, she snapped, stalking around to get in his face. She pointed to the edge again. We're flying, you rutting coward. He tucked his head toward his belly, his tail wrapping around him. He was pretending he couldn't hear her. She knew it might cost her life, but she gripped his nostrils, hard enough to make his eyes fly open. Your wings are functional. The humans said they were. So you can fly, and you are going to fly because I say so. I've been fetching your useless carcass mountain goats by the herd, and if you humiliate me, I'll use your hide for a new leather coat. She rustled her torn and stained crimson cloak. This is ruined thanks to your goats. He shifted his head away, and she let go, because it was either let go or be tossed into the air. He set down his head and closed his eyes. This was punishment somehow, for what she didn't know. Perhaps her own stupidity in picking a bait beast for a mount. She hissed to herself, eyeing the saddle on his back. Even with a running jump, she couldn't make it. But she needed to be in that saddle and airborne, or else the 13 would be broken apart by her grandmother. Abraxos continued to lie in the sun, vain and indulgent as a cat. Warrior heart indeed. She eyed the eastern edge, the saddle, the dangling reins. He'd bucked and thrashed the first time they'd shoved the bit into his mouth, but he'd gotten used to it now. At least, enough so that he'd tried to take off the head of only one handler today. The sun was still rising high, but soon it would start its descent, and then she'd be completely and perfectly ruined. Like hell she would be. You had this coming, was all the warning she gave him, before she took a running leap, landing on his haunch and then scrambling, so fast he had barely lifted his head by the time she scuttled across his scaly back and into the saddle. He jerked upright, stiff as a board as she shoved her booted feet into the stirrups and gripped the reins. We're flying. Now. She dug her heels into his sides.
Perhaps the spurs hurt or surprised him, because Abraxos bucked. Bucked and roared. She yanked on the reins as hard as she could.
Enough,
she barked, hauling with one arm to guide him over the eastern edge.
Enough, Abraxos!
He was still thrashing, and she clenched her thighs as hard as she could to stay in the saddle, leaning into each movement. When the bucking didn't dislodge her, he lifted his wings as if he would fling her off.
Don't you dare,
she growled. But he was still twisting and bellowing.
Stop it!
Her brain rattled in her skull, and her teeth clacked together so hard she had to retract her fangs so they didn't punch right through her skin. But Abraxos kept bucking, wild and frantic. Not toward the eastern edge, but away, toward the lip of the western plunge.
Abraxos, stop!
He was going to go right over, and then they'd splatter on the stones. He was so panicked, so enraged, that her voice was no more than a crackling leaf on the wind. The western drop loomed to her right, then her left, flashing beneath the leathery mottled wings as they flapped and snapped. Under Abraxos's massive talons, stones hissed and crumbled as he neared the edge.
Abraxos!
But then his legs slid off the cliff. And Manon's world tilted down, 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 as he lost his grip, and they plummeted into open air. Chapter 32 Manon didn't have time to contemplate her oncoming death. She was too busy holding on to the saddle, the world flipping and spinning, the wind shrieking, or perhaps that was Abraxos, as they plunged down the cliff face. Her muscles locked and trembled, but she kept her arms laced through the straps, the only thing keeping her from death, even as it swiftly approached with every rotation of Abraxos's ruined body. The trees below took shape, as did the spiked wind-carved rocks between them. Faster and faster, the cliff wall a blur of gray and white. Maybe his body would take the impact and she could walk away. Maybe all those rocks would go right through them both. Maybe he'd flip and she would land on the rocks first. She hoped it would happen too quickly for her to recognize just how she was dying, to know what part of her broke first. They hurtled down. There was a little river running through the spiked rocks. Wind slammed into them from below. A draft that rocked Abraxos upright. But they were still rotating, still plunging.
Open your wings!
She screamed over the wind, over her thundering heart. They stayed shut.
Open them and pull up!
She bellowed, just as the rapids on the stream began to appear. Just as she understood that she hated the oncoming embrace of the darkness, and that there was nothing to do to stop this splattering, this doom from... She could see the pine cones on the trees.
Open them!
A last rallying war cry against the darkness. A war cry that was answered with a piercing shriek as Abraxos flung open his wings, caught the updraft, and sent them soaring away from the ground. Manon's stomach went from her throat right out her ass, but they were swooping upward, and his wings were pumping, each boom the most beautiful sound she had ever heard in her long, miserable life. Higher he flapped, legs tucked beneath him. Manon crouched in her saddle, clinging to his warm hide as he took them up the face of the neighboring mountain. Its peaks rose to meet them like lifted hands, but he wobbled past, beating hard. Manon lifted and fell with him, not taking one breath, as they cleared the highest snow-capped peak, and Abraxos, in joy or rage or for the hell of it, gripped clawfuls of snow and ice and set them scattering behind, the sun lighting them up like a trail of stars. The sun was blinding as they hit the open sky, and there was nothing around them but clouds as massive as the mountains far below, castles and temples of white and purple and blue.
and the cry that Abraxos let out as they entered that hall of clouds. As he leveled out and caught a lightning-fast current carving a pathway through it. She had not understood what it had been like for him to live his entire life underground, chained and beaten and crippled. Until then. Until she heard that noise of undiluted, unyielding joy. Until she echoed it, tipping her head back to the clouds around them. They sailed over a sea of clouds, and Abraxos dipped his claws in them before tilting to race up a wind-carved column of cloud, higher and higher, until they reached its peak, and he flung out his wings in the freezing thin sky, stopping the world entirely for a heartbeat. And Manon, because no one was watching, because she did not care, flung out her arms as well and savored the free fall. The wind now a song in her ears, in her shriveled heart. The gray skies were just filling with light as the sun slipped over the horizon at their backs. Bundled in her red cloak, Manon sat atop Abraxos, her vision slightly cloudy from the inner lid she'd already blinked into place. Still, she surveyed her 13, astride their wyverns at the mouth of the canyon run. They'd assembled in two rows of six, Asterin and her pale blue mount directly behind Manon, leading the first row, Sorrel claiming center in the second. They were all awake and alert, and slightly befuddled. Abraxos's damaged wings weren't ready to make the narrow crossing, not yet, so they'd met at the back door, where they'd walked their wyverns the 2 miles to the first canyon run. Walked like a proper unit, in rank and quietly. The mouth of the canyon was wide enough for Abraxos to leap into an easy glide. Takeoffs were a problem thanks to the shredded muscle and weak spots in his wings, areas that had taken too many beatings and might never be at their full strength. But she did not need to explain that to her 13, because it was none of their damn business, and it did not impact them. "Every morning, from today until the war games," Manon said, staring into the labyrinth of ravines and archways that made up the wind-carved canyon. "We will meet here, and until breakfast we are going to train. Then we will have our afternoon training with the other covens. Tell no one." She'd just have to leave early so she could get Abraxos airborne while the others made the crossing. "I want us in close quarters. I don't care what the men say about keeping the mount separate. Let the wyverns sort out their dominance. Let them squabble. But they are going to fly, tight as armor. There will be no gaps and no room for attitude or territorial horseshit. We fly this cannon together, or we don't fly at all." She looked each of the witches and their mounts in the eye. Abraxos, to her surprise, did the same. What he lacked in size, he made up for in sheer will, speed, and dexterity. He sensed currents even before Manon did. "When we are done, if we survive, we'll meet on the other side and do it again. Until it's perfect. Your beasts will learn to trust each other and follow orders." The wind kissed her cheeks. "Don't fall behind," she said. And Abraxos plunged into the canyon. Chapter 33. In the week that followed, there were no more bodies, and certainly no hint of the creature that had drained those people. Though Selena often found herself thinking over the details, as Rowan made her light candle after candle, at the ruins of the sun goddess's temple. Now that she could shift on command, this was her new task, to light a candle without destroying everything in sight. She failed every time, singeing her cloak, cracking the ruins, incinerating trees as her magic tore out of her. But Rowan had a bottomless supply of candles, so she spent her days staring at them until her eyes crossed.
She could sweat for hours and focus on honing her anger and all that nonsense, but not get as much as a tendril of smoke. The only thing that came of it was an unending appetite. Selena ate whatever and whenever she could, thanks to her magic gobbling so much of her energy. The rain returned, and with it the crowd for Emrys's stories. Selena always listened while she washed the night's dishes, to tales of shield maidens and enchanted animals and cunning sorcerers, all the legends of Wendolin. Rowan still appeared in his hawk form, and there were some nights when she even sat beside the back door, and Rowan sidled a bit closer too. Selena was standing at the sink, back throbbing and hunger gnawing at her belly, as she scrubbed the last of the copper pots, while Emrys finished narrating the story of a clever wolf and a magical firebird. There was a pause, and then came the usual requests for the same old stories. Selena didn't acknowledge the heads that turned in her direction, as she asked from the sink, "Do you know any stories about Queen Maeve?" Dead silence. Emrys's eyes widened before he smiled faintly and said,
"Lots. Which one would you like to hear?"
"The earliest ones that you know?" "All of them." If she was going to face her aunt again, perhaps she should start learning as much as she could. Emrys might know stories that hadn't reached the shores of her own lands. If the stories about the skinwalkers had been true, if the immortal stags were real, perhaps she could glean something vital here. There were some nervous glances, but at last Emrys said,
"Then I shall start at the beginning."
Selena nodded and moved to sit in her usual chair, propped against the back door next to the sharp-eyed hawk. Rowan clicked his beak, but she didn't dare look over her shoulder at him. Instead, she dug into an entire loaf of bread.
"Long ago, when there was no mortal king on Wendland's throne, the fairies still walked among us. Some were good and fair, some were prone to little mischiefs, and some were fouler and darker than the blackest night. But they were all of them ruled by Maeve and her two sisters, whom they called Mora and Mab. Cunning Mora, who bore the shape of a great hawk."
That was Rowan's mighty bloodline.
"Fair Mab, who bore the shape of a swan. And the dark Maeve, whose wildness could not be contained by any single form."
Emrys recited the history, much of which Selena knew. Mora and Mab had fallen in love with human men, and yielded their immortality. Some said Maeve forced them to give up their gift of eternal life as punishment. Some said they wanted to, if only to escape their sister. And when Selena asked, the room falling deathly silent again, if Maeve herself had ever mated, Emrys told her no, though she had come close at the dawn of time. A warrior, rumor claimed, had stolen her heart with his clever mind and pure soul. But he had died in some long-ago war, and lost the ring he'd intended for her. And since then, Maeve had cherished her warriors above all others. They loved her for it, made her a mighty queen whom no one dared challenge. Selena expected Rowan to puff his feathers at that, but he remained still and quiet on his perch. Emrys told stories about the Fae Queen well into the night, painting a portrait of a ruthless, cunning ruler who could conquer the world if she wished, but instead kept to her forest realm of Doranel, planting her stone city in the heart of a massive river basin. Selena picked through the details and committed them to memory, trying not to think about the prince perched a few feet above her, who had willingly sworn a blood oath to the immortal monster who dwelled beyond the mountains. She was about to ask for another story, when she caught the motion in the trees. She choked on the piece of blackberry pie she was in the middle of devouring, as the massive mountain cat trotted from the forest and across the rain-drenched grass, heading right for their door. The rain had darkened its golden fur,
and its eyes gleamed in the torches. Did the guards not see it? Malachi was listening to his mate with rapt attention. She opened her mouth to shout a warning when she paused. The guards saw everything and weren't shooting because it wasn't a mountain cat, but in a flash that could have been distant lightning, the mountain cat became a tall, broad-shouldered male walking toward the open door. Rowan surged into flight, then shifted, seamlessly landing mid-stride as he walked into the rain. The two males clasped forearms and clapped each other on the back, a quick, efficient greeting. With the rain and Emrys's narrating, it was hard to hear, and she silently cursed her mortal ears as she strained to listen.
"I've been looking for you for 6 weeks," the golden-haired stranger said, his voice sharp but hollow.
Not urgent, but tired and frustrated.
"Vaughn said you were at the eastern border, but Lorkin said you were on the coast inspecting the fleet. Then the twins told me that the Queen had been all the way out here with you and returned alone, so I came on a hunch."
He was babbling, his lack of control at odds with his hard muscles and the weapons strapped to him. A warrior, like Rowan, though his surprisingly lovely face had none of the prince's severity. Rowan put a hand on the male's shoulder.
"I heard what happened, Gavriel."
Was this one of Rowan's mysterious friends? She wished Emrys were free to identify him. Rowan had told her so little about his five companions, but it was clear that Rowan and Gavriel were more than acquaintances. She sometimes forgot that Rowan had a life beyond this fortress. It hadn't bothered her before, and she wasn't sure why remembering it now suddenly settled in her stomach like a dead weight, or why it suddenly mattered that Rowan at least acknowledged that she was there, that she existed. Gavriel scrubbed at his face, his heavily muscled back expanding as he took a breath.
"I know you probably don't want to.
Just tell me what you want, and it will be done."
Gavriel seemed to deflate, and Rowan guided him toward another door. They both moved with unearthly, powerful grace, as if the rain itself parted to let them through. Rowan didn't even look back at her before he disappeared. Rowan didn't come back for the rest of the night, and curiosity, not kindness, made her realize his friend probably hadn't had dinner. At least, no one had brought anything out of the kitchen, and Rowan hadn't called for food. So why not bring up a tray of stew and bread? Balancing the heavy tray on her hip, she knocked on his door. The murmuring within went silent, and for a second, she had the mortifying thought that perhaps the male was here for a far more intimate reason. Then someone snapped,
"What?"
And she eased open the door wide enough to glance in.
"I thought you might want some stew and..."
Well, the stranger was half naked and lying on his back atop Rowan's work table. But Rowan was fully clothed, seated before him, and looking pissed as hell. Yes. She had certainly walked in on something private. It took a heartbeat to note the flattened needles, the small cauldron-shaped vat of dark pigment, the rag soaked with ink and blood, and the tracings of a tattoo snaking from the stranger's left pectoral down his ribs and right to his hip bone.
"Get out,"
Rowan said flatly, lowering the needle. Gavriel lifted his head, the bright candles showing tawny eyes glazed with pain, and not necessarily from the markings being etched over his heart and ribcage. Words in the old language, just like Rowan's. There were already so many, most of them aged and interrupted by various scars.
"Do you want the stew?"
she asked, still staring at the tattoo, the blood, the little iron pot of ink, and the way Rowan seemed as much at ease with the tools in his hands as he did with his weapons. Had he made his own tattoo?
"Leave it,"
he said. And she knew, just knew, that he would bite her head off later.
schooling her features into neutrality, she set the tray on the bed and walked back to the door. Sorry to interrupt. Whatever the tattoos were for, however they knew each other, she had no right to be in here. The pain in the stranger's eyes told her enough. She'd seen it in her own reflection plenty. Gavriel's attention darted between her and Rowan, his nostrils flaring. He was smelling her. It was definitely time to get the hell out.
Sorry,
she said again, and shut the door behind her. She made it 2 steps down the hall before she had to stop and lean against the stone wall, rubbing at her face. Stupid. Stupid to even care what he did outside of training. To think he might consider sharing personal information with her. Even if it was only that he was retiring to his rooms early. It hurt, though. More than she wanted to admit. She was about to drag herself to her room when the door flung open down the hall, and Rowan stormed out, practically glowing with ire. But just seeing the lividness written all over him had her riding that reckless, stupid edge again, and clinging to the anger was easier than embracing the quiet darkness that wanted to pull her down, down, down. Before he could start shouting, she asked, "Do you do it for money?" A flicker of teeth.
"1, it's none of your business. And 2, I would never stoop so low."
The look he gave her told her exactly what he thought of her profession. "You know, it might be better if you just slapped me instead."
"Instead of what?"
"Instead of reminding me again and again how rutting, worthless, and awful and cowardly I am. Believe me, I can do the job well enough on my own. So just hit me because I'm damned tired of trading insults. And you know what? You didn't even bother to tell me you'd become unavailable. If you'd said something, I never would have come. I'm sorry I did, but you just left me downstairs." Saying those last words made a sharp, quick panic rise up in her. An aching pain that had her throat closing. "You left me," she repeated. Maybe it was only out of blind terror at the abyss opening up again around her. But she whispered,
"I have no one left. No one."
She hadn't realized how much she meant it. How much she needed it not to be true. Until now. His features remained impassive, turning vicious even, as he said,
"There is nothing that I can give you. Nothing I want to give you. You are not owed an explanation for what I do outside of training. I don't care what you have been through or what you want to do with your life. The sooner you can sort out your whining and self-pity, the sooner I can be rid of you. You are nothing to me, and I do not care."
There was a faint ringing in her ears that turned into a roar. And beneath it, a sudden wave of numbness. A too familiar lack of sight or sound or feeling. She didn't know why it happened, because she had been so dead set on hating him. But it would have been nice, she supposed. It would have been nice to have one person who knew the absolute truth about her and didn't hate her for it. It would have been really, really nice. She walked away without another word. With each step she took back to her room, that flickering light inside of her guttered and went out. Chapter 34 Selena did not remember curling up in her bed, boots still on. She did not remember her dreams, or feel the pangs of hunger or thirst when she awoke. And she could barely respond to anyone as she trudged down to the kitchen and set about helping with breakfast. Everything swirled past in dull colors and whispers of sound. But she was still. A bit of rock in a stream. Breakfast passed. And when it was done, in the quiet of the kitchen,
The sounds sorted out into voices. A murmur. Malachi. A laugh. Emrys.
Look,
Emrys said, coming up to where Selena stood at the kitchen sink, still staring out at the field.
Look what Malachi bought me.
She caught the flash of the golden hilt before she understood Emrys was holding out a new knife.
It was a joke. The gods had to be playing a joke. Or they just truly, truly hated her.
The hilt was engraved with lotus blossoms, a ripple of lapis lazuli edging the bottom like a river wave. Emrys was smiling, eyes bright. But that knife, the gold polished and bright.
I got it from a merchant from the southern continent,
Malachi said from the table, his satisfied tone enough to tell her that he was beaming.
It came all the way from Ilwe.
The numbness snapped. Snapped with such a violent crack that she was surprised they didn't hear it. And in its place was a screaming, high-pitched and keening, loud as a tea kettle, loud as a storm wind, loud as the sound the maid had emitted the morning she'd walked into Selena's parents' bedroom and seen the child lying between their corpses. It was so loud that she could hardly hear herself as she said, I do not care. She couldn't hear anything over that silent screaming, so she raised her own voice, breath coming fast, too fast, as she repeated, I do not care. Silence. Then Luca warily said from across the room,
Alentia, don't be rude.
Alentia. Alentia. Spirit that cannot be broken.
Lies. 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 Nehemia had lied about everything. About her stupid name, about her plans, about every damn thing. And she was gone. All that Selena would have left of her were reminders like this. Weapons similar to the ones the princess had worn with such pride. Nehemia was gone, and she had nothing left. Trembling so hard she thought her body would fall apart at the seams, she turned. I do not care about you, she hissed to Emrys and Malachi and Luca. I do not care about your knife. I do not care about your stories or your little kingdom. She pinned Emrys with a stare. Luca and Malachi were across the room in an instant, stepping in front of the old man, teeth bared. Good. They should feel threatened. So leave me alone. Keep your goddamned lives to yourself and leave me alone. She was shouting now, but she couldn't stop hearing the screaming, couldn't hone the anger into anything, couldn't tell which way was up or down. Only that Nehemia had lied about everything, and her friend once had sworn an oath not to. Sworn an oath and broken it. Just as she'd broken Selena's own heart the day she let herself die. She saw the tears in Emrys's eyes then. Sorrow or pity or anger, she didn't care. Luca and Malachi were still between them, growling softly. A family. They were a family, and they stuck together. They would rip her apart if she hurt one of them. Selena let out a low, joyless laugh as she took in the three of them. Emrys opened his mouth to say whatever it was he thought would help. But Selena let out another dead laugh and walked out the door. After an entire night of tattooing the names of the fallen onto Gavriel's flesh, and listening to the warrior talk about the men he'd lost, Rowan sent him on his way and headed for the kitchen. He found it empty save for the ancient male, who sat at the empty work table, hands wrapped around a mug. Emrys looked up, his eyes bright and grieving. The girl was nowhere to be seen,
and for a heartbeat he hoped she'd left again, if only so he didn't have to face what he'd said yesterday. The door to the outside was open, as if someone had thrown it wide. She'd probably gone that way. Rowan took a step toward it, nodding his greeting, but the old male looked him up and down and quietly said,
"What are you doing?"
"What?" Emrys didn't raise his voice as he said,
"To that girl. What are you doing that makes her come in here with such emptiness in her eyes?
That's none of your concern."
Emrys pressed his lips into a tight line.
"What do you see when you look at her, Prince?"
He didn't know. These days, he didn't know a damn thing.
"That's none of your concern, either."
Emrys ran a hand over his weathered face.
"I see her slipping away, bit by bit. Because you shove her down when she so desperately needs someone to help her back up.
I don't see why I would be of any use to...
Did you know that Evelyn Ashriver was my friend?
She spent almost a year working in this kitchen, living here with us, fighting to convince your queen that demi-fae have a place in your realm. She fought for our rights until the very day she departed this kingdom. And the many years after, until she was murdered by those monsters across the sea. So I knew. I knew who her daughter was the moment you brought her into this kitchen. All of us who were here 25 years ago recognized her for what she is."
It wasn't often that he was surprised, but... Rowan just stared.
"She has no hope, Prince. She has no hope left in her heart. Help her. If not for her sake, then at least for what she represents. What she could offer all of us, you included."
"And what is that?"
he dared ask. Emrys met his gaze unflinchingly as he whispered,
"A better world."
Selena walked and walked until she found herself by the tree-lined shore of a lake, glaringly bright in the midday sun. She figured it was as good a spot as any as she crumpled to the mossy bank, as her arms wrapped tight around herself, and she bowed over her knees. There was nothing that could be done to fix her. And she was. A whimpering noise came out of her, lips trembling so hard she had to clamp down to keep the sound inside. But the sound was in her throat, and her lungs, and her mouth. And when she took a breath, it cracked out. Once she heard it, everything came spilling into the world, until her body ached with the force of it. She vaguely felt the light shifting on the lake. Vaguely felt the sighing wind, warm as it brushed against her damp cheeks. And heard, so soft it was as if she dreamed it, a woman's voice, whispering, "Why are you crying, Fireheart?" It had been 10 years. 10 long years since she had heard her mother's voice. But she heard it then over the force of her weeping, as clear as if she knelt beside her. "Fireheart, why do you cry?"
"Because I am lost,"
she whispered onto the earth.
"And I do not know the way."
It was what she had never been able to tell Nehemia, that for 10 years she had been unsure how to find the way home, because there was no home left. Storm winds and ice crackled against her skin before she registered Rowan sitting down beside her, legs out, palms braced behind him in the moss. She raised her head, but didn't bother to wipe her face as she stared across the glittering lake.
"You want to talk about it?"
he asked.
"No."
Swallowing a few times, she yanked a handkerchief from her pocket and blew her nose, her head clearing with each breath. They sat in silence. No sound but the quiet lapping of the lake on the mossy bank and the wind in the leaves. Then,
good. Because we're going.
Bastard. She called him as much, and then asked,
going where?
He smiled grimly.
I think I've started to figure you out, Aelin Galathinius.
What in every burning ring of hell? Selena panted, gazing at the cave mouth nestled into the base of the craggy mountain. Are we doing here? It had been a 5-mile hike, uphill, with hardly anything in her stomach. The trees butted against the gray stones, flowing up the slope for a ways, and then fading into lichen-covered rock that eventually turned into the snow-capped peak that marked the barrier between Wendlin and Doranel beyond. For some reason, this hulking giant made the hair on her neck stand up, and it had nothing to do with the frozen wind. Rowan strode into the gaping maw of the cave mouth, his pale gray cloak flapping behind him.
Hurry up.
Pulling her own cloak tighter around her, she staggered after him. This was a bad sign. A horrible sign, actually, because whatever was in that cave. She walked into the dark, following Rowan by the light on his hair, letting her eyes adjust. The ground was rocky, the stones small and worn smooth, and littered with rusted weapons, armor, and clothes. No skeletons. Gods, it was so cold that she could see her breath. See, tell me I'm hallucinating. Rowan had stopped at the edge of an enormous frozen lake, stretching into the gloom. Sitting on a blanket in its center, the chains around his wrists anchored under the ice, was Luca. Luca's chains clanked as he raised a hand in greeting.
I thought you'd never show. I'm freezing, he called,
and tucked his hands back under his arms. The sound echoed throughout the chamber. The thick sheet of ice covering the lake was so clear that she could see the water beneath, pale stones on the bottom, what looked to be old roots from trees long dead, and no sign of life whatsoever. An occasional sword or dagger or lance poked up from the stones. What is this place?
Go get him, was Rowan's answer.
Are you out of your mind? Rowan gave her a smile that suggested he was, in fact, insane. She stepped toward the ice, but he blocked her path with a muscled arm.
In your other form.
Luca's head was angled, as if trying to hear. He doesn't know what I am, she murmured.
You've been living in a fortress of demi-fae, you know. He won't care.
That was the least of her concerns, anyway.
How dare you drag him into this? You dragged him in yourself when you insulted him and Emrys. The least you can do is retrieve him.
He blew out a breath toward the lake, and the ice thawed by the shore, then hardened. Holy gods. He'd frozen the whole damn lake. He was that powerful?
I hope you brought snacks, Luca said.
I'm starving. Hurry up, Alentia. Rowan said you had to do this as part of your training, and he prattled on and on. What is the goddamned point of this? Just punishment for acting like an ass?
You can control your power in human form. Keep it dormant. But the moment you switch, the moment you get agitated or angry or afraid, the moment you remember how much your power scares you, your magic rises up to protect you. It doesn't understand that you are the source of those feelings, not some external threat. When there is an outside threat, when you forget to fear your power long enough, you have control. Or some control.
He pointed again to the sheet of ice between her and Luca.
So free him.
If she lost control, if her fire got out of her, well, fire and ice certainly went well together, didn't they? What happens to Luca if I fail?
He'll be very cold and very wet, and possibly die.
From the smile on his face, she knew he was enough of a sadist to let the boy go under with her. Were the chains really necessary? He'll go right to the bottom. A stupid, bleeding kind of panic was starting to fill her veins. When she held out her hand for the key to Luca's chains, Rowan shook his head.
Control is your key, and focus. Cross the lake, then figure out how to free him without drowning the both of you.
Don't give me a lesson like you're some mystical nonsense master. This is the stupidest thing I have ever had to—
Hurry,
Rowan said with a wolfish grin, and the ice gave a collective groan, as if it was melting. Though some small voice in her head told her he wouldn't let the boy drown, she couldn't trust him, not after last night. She took one step closer to the ice.
You are a bastard.
When Luca was safely home, she would start finding ways to make Rowan's life a living hell. She punched through her inner veil, the pain barely registering as her features shifted.
I was waiting to see your fae form, Luca said. We were all taking bets on when...
And on and on. She scowled at Rowan, his tattoo even more detailed now that she was seeing it with fae eyes.
It gives me comfort to know that people like you have a special place in hell waiting for them.
Tell me something I don't already know. She gave him a particularly vulgar gesture as she stepped onto the ice. As she took each tentative step, small ones at first, she could see the lake bottom sloping away into darkness, swallowing the spread of lost weapons. Luca had finally shut up. It was only when she stepped past the visible edge of the rocky shelf and hovered over the dark depths that her breath hitched. She slid her foot, and the ice groaned. Groaned and cracked, spiderwebbing under her foot. She froze, gaping like a fool as the crack spread wider and wider. And then she kept moving. There was another crack beneath her boots. Did the ice move?
Stop it, she hissed at Rowan,
but didn't dare look behind her. Her magic shuddered awake, and she went still as death.
No.
But there it was, filling up the spaces in her. The ice emitted a deep groan that could only mean something cold and wet was coming her way really damn soon, and she took another step, if only because the way back seemed like it would shatter. She was sweating now. The magic. The fire was warming her from the inside out.
Valentia?
Luca asked, and she held out a hand toward him, a silent gesture to shut his stupid mouth as she closed her eyes and breathed, imagining the cold air around them filling her lungs, freezing over the well of power.
Magic.
It was magic. In Otterlin, it was a death trap. She clenched her hands into fists. Here, it was not a death trap. In this land, she could have it, could wear whatever form she wished. The ice stopped groaning, but it had clouded and thinned around her. She started sliding her feet, keeping as balanced and fluid as she could, humming a melody, a bit of a symphony that used to calm her. She let the beat anchor her, dull the edge of her panic. The magic simmered to embers, pulsing with each breath.
I am safe,
she told it. Relatively safe. If Rowan was right, and it was just a reaction to protect her from some enemy. Fire was the reason she'd been banned from the Library of Orinth when she was 8,
after accidentally incinerating an entire bookcase of ancient manuscripts, when she grew irritated with the master scholar lecturing her about decorum. It had been a beautiful, horrible relief to wake up one day not too many months after that, and no magic was gone. That she could hold a book, hold what she adored most, and not worry about turning it to ash if she became upset or tired or excited. Selena Sardothian, gloriously mortal Selena, never had to worry about accidentally scorching a playmate or having a nightmare that might incinerate her bedroom or burning all of Orinth to the ground. Selena had been everything Aelin wasn't. She had embraced that life, even if Selena's accomplishments were death and torture and pain.
Valentia?
She'd been staring at the ice. Her magic flickered again. Burning a city to the ground. That was the fear she overheard Melisande's emissary hiss at her parents and uncle. She'd been told he had come to see about an alliance, but she later understood he'd really come to gather information on her. Melisande had a young queen on its throne, and she wanted to assess the threat she might face from the heir of Terrasen one day. Wanted to know if Aelin Galathinius would become a weapon of war. The ice fogged over, and a crack splintered through the air. The magic was pulsing its way out of her, snapping its jaws at every breath she took.
You are in control now, Rowan said from the shore. You are its master.
She was halfway there. She took one more step toward Luca, and the ice cracked further. His chains rustled. Impatience or fear? She had never been in control. Even as Selena, control had been an illusion. Other masters had held her reins.
You are the keeper of your own fate,
Rowan said softly from the shore, as if he knew exactly what was flowing through her head. She hummed some more, the music wending its way from her memory. And somehow the flame grew quiet. Selena took a step forward, then another. The power smoldering in her veins would never go away. She was far more likely to hurt someone if she didn't master it. She scowled over her shoulder at Rowan, who was now striding along the shore, examining some of the fallen blades. There was a hint of triumph in his usually hollow eyes. But he turned away and approached a small crevice in the cave wall, feeling for something inside. She kept walking, the watery abyss deepening. She had mastered her mortal body as an assassin. Mastering her immortal power was just another task. Luca's eyes were wide as she came at last within touching distance.
You have nothing to hide, you know. We all knew you could shift anyway,
he said.
And if it makes you feel any better, Sten's animal form is a pig. He won't even shift for shame.
She would have laughed, actually felt her insides tighten to bark out the sound that had been buried for months. But then she remembered the chains around his wrists. The magic had quieted down, but now, melt through them? Or melt the ice where they were anchored and let him drag the chains back? If she went for the ice, she could easily send them right to the bottom of this ancient lake. And if she went for the chains, well, she could lose control and send them to the bottom, but she could also wind up burning him. At best, branding him where the manacles were. At worst, melting his bones. Better to risk the ice. Luca said. Oh, forgive every awful thing you said earlier if we can go eat something right now. It smells awful in here. His senses had to be sharper than hers. The cave had only a faint hint of rust, mold, and rotting things. Just hold still and stop talking, she said, more sharply than she'd intended. But
But he shut up as she eased to the spot where Rowan had frozen the chains. As carefully as she could, she knelt, spreading her weight out evenly. She slid one palm against the ice, eyeing the chain's path to the hanging length swaying in the water beneath. Swaying. There must be a current, which meant Rowan had to be constantly sealing the ice. The cold bit into her palm, and she eyed Luca on the fur blanket before she turned back to the anchor. If the ice broke, she'd have to grab him. Rowan was out of his damned mind. She took several long breaths, letting the magic calm and cool and gutter. Then, hand pressed flat against the ice, she crooked an inner finger at her power and pulled out a tiny, burning thread. It flowed down her arm, snaked around her wrist, and then settled in her palm, her skin warming, the ice glowing a bright red. Luca yelped as the ice splintered around them.
"Control!"
Rowan barked from the shore, pulling free a discarded sword from where it had been knocked into the little crevice in the wall, its golden hilt glinting. Selena clamped on the magic so hard it suffocated. A small hole had melted where her palm had been, but not all the way through. Not big enough to free the chain. She could master this. She could master herself again. The well inside of her filled up, and she pushed back, willing only that thread to squeeze free and into the ice, burrowing like a worm, gnawing away at the cold. There was a clank of metal, and a hiss, and then, "Oh, thank gods," Luca moaned, hauling the length of the chain out of the hole. She spooled the thread of power back into herself, into that well, and was suddenly cold. "Please tell me you brought food," Luca said again. "Is that why you came? Rowan promised you snacks?" "I'm a growing boy." He winced when he looked at Rowan. "And you don't say no to him." No, indeed. No one ever said no to him. And that was probably why Rowan thought a scheme like this was acceptable. Selena sighed through her nose and looked at the small hole she'd made. A feat. A miracle. As she was about to stand and help Luca navigate the way back to shore, she glanced at the ice once more. No, not the ice. The water beneath, where a giant red eye was staring right at her. Chapter 35. The next four words that came out of Selena's mouth were so vulgar that Luca choked. But Selena didn't move as a massive, jagged white line gleamed unnervingly far from that red eye. "Get off the ice, now," she breathed to Luca. Because that jagged white line, those were teeth. Big, rip-your-arm-off-in-one-bite teeth. And they were floating up from the depths, toward the hole she'd made. That was why there were no skeletons. Only the weapons that had failed the fools who'd wandered into this cave.
"Holy gods," Luca said, peering from behind her. "What is that?"
"Shut up and go," she hissed. On the shore, Rowan's eyes were wide, his face strained beneath his tattoo. He hadn't realized this lake wasn't empty.
"Now, Luca,"
Rowan growled, his sword out, the blade he'd swiped from the ground still sheathed in his other hand. It was swimming toward them, lazily, curious. As it neared, she could make out a snaking body as pale as the stones on the bottom of the lake. She'd never seen anything so huge, so ancient, and there was only a thin layer of ice keeping her separated from it. When Luca started trembling, his tan skin going pale, Selena surged to her feet, the ice groaning.
"Don't look down," she said, gripping his elbow.
A patch of thicker ice hardened under their feet and spread, a path for the shore.
"Go,"
she told the boy,
giving him a light shove. He started into a swift shuffle slide. She let him get ahead, giving him time so she could guard his back, and glanced down again. She swallowed her shout as a scaled, massive head stared up at her. Not a dragon or a wyvern, not a serpent or a fish, but something in between. It was missing an eye, the flesh scarred around the empty socket. What in hell had done that? Was there something worse down there, swimming at the belly of the mountain? Of course. Of course she'd be left unarmed in the center of a lake lined with weapons.
Faster,
Rowan barked. Luca was already halfway to the shore. Selena broke into Luca's same shuffle slide, not trusting herself to stay upright if she ran. Just as she took her third step, a flash of bone white snapped up through the depths, twisting like a striking asp. The long tail whipped against the ice, and the world bounced. She went up, legs buckling as the ice lifted from the blow, and then slammed onto her hands and knees. Selena shoved down the magic that arose to protect and burn and maim. She scrambled and veered aside as the scaly horned head hurtled toward the ice near her feet. The surface jolted. Farther out, but getting closer, the ice was breaking, as if all of Rowan's concentration was now spent on keeping a thin bridge of ice frozen between her and the shore.
Weapon!
She gasped out, not daring to take her attention off the creature.
Hurry!
Rowan barked. And Selena lifted her head long enough to see him slide the blade he'd found across the ice, a brisk wind spinning it toward her. Luca abandoned the blanket, shuffle running, and Selena scooped up the golden hilt of the sword as she followed him. A ruby the size of a chicken egg was embedded in the hilt, and despite the age of the scabbard, the blade shone when she whipped it free, as if it had been freshly polished. Something clattered from the scabbard onto the ice. A plain golden ring. She grabbed it, shoving it into her pocket, and ran faster as the ice lifted again, the boom of that mighty tail as horrific as the moving surface beneath her. Selena stayed up this time, sinking onto her haunches as she clutched the sword, part of her marveling at the balance and beauty of it. But Luca, slipping and sliding, went down. She reached him in a few heartbeats, hauling him up by the back of his tunic and gripping him tight as the ice lifted again and again and again. They got past the drop-off, and she almost groaned with relief at the sight of the pale stone shelf beneath their feet. The ice behind them exploded up, freezing water showering them. And then she didn't stop as those nostrils huffed, didn't stop hauling Luca toward Rowan, whose brow gleamed with sweat as massive talons scraped over the ice, gouging four deep lines. She dragged the boy the last 10 yards, then 5, then they were on the shore and to Rowan, who let out a shuddering breath. Selena turned in time to see something out of a nightmare trying to crawl onto the ice, its one red eye wild with hunger, its massive teeth promising a brutal and cold kind of death. As Rowan's sigh finished sounding, the ice melted, and the creature plunged below. Back on solid ground, suddenly aware that the ice had also been a barrier, Selena again grabbed Luca, who was looking ready to vomit, and bolted from the cave. There was nothing keeping that creature from climbing out of the water, and the sword was about as useful as a toothpick against it. Who knew how fast it could move on land? Luca was chanting a steady stream of prayers to various gods as Selena yanked him down the rocky path and into the glaring afternoon sun, stumbling near blind until they hit the murky woods, dodging trees mostly by luck, faster and faster downhill. And then a roar that shook the stones and sent the birds scattering into the air, the leaves rustling. But a roar of rage and hunger, not of triumph,
as if the creature had reached the edge of the cave and, after millennia in the watery dark, could not withstand the sunshine. She didn't want to consider, as they kept running from the echoing roar, what might have happened if it had been night, what still might happen at nightfall. After a while, she sensed Rowan behind them, yet she cared only for her young charge, who panted and cursed all the way back to the fortress. When Mistward was in sight, she told Luca only one thing before she sent him ahead. Keep his mouth shut about what had happened in the cave. The moment the sounds of him crashing through the brush had faded, she turned. Rowan was standing there, panting as well, his sword now sheathed. She plunged her new blade into the earth, the ruby in the hilt glowing in a patch of sunlight. I will kill you, she snarled, and launched herself at him. Even in her fey form, he was still faster than her, stronger, and dodged her with fluid ease. Slamming face first into the tree was better than colliding with the stone walls of the fortress, though not by much. Her teeth sang, but she whirled and lunged for Rowan again, now standing so close, his teeth bared. He couldn't dodge her as she grabbed him by the front of his jacket and connected. Oh, hitting him in the face felt good, even as her knuckles split and throbbed. He snarled and threw her to the ground. The air whooshed out of her chest, and the blood trickling out of her nose shot back down her throat. Before he could sit on her, she got her legs around him and shoved with every ounce of that immortal strength. And just like that, he was pinned, his eyes wide with what could only be fury and surprise. She hit him again, her knuckles barking in agony. If you ever again bring someone else into this, she panted, hitting him on his tattoo, on that goddamned tattoo. If you ever endanger anyone else the way you did today. The blood on her nose splattered on his face, mingling, she noted with some satisfaction, with blood from the blows she'd given him. I will kill you. Another strike, a backhanded blow, and it vaguely occurred to her that he had gone still and was taking it. I will rip out your rutting throat. She bared her canines. You understand? He turned his head to the side to spit blood. Her blood was pounding, so wild that every little restraint she'd locked into place shattered. She shoved back against it, and the distraction cost her. Rowan moved, and then she was under him again. She'd mangled his face, but he didn't seem to care as he growled, I will do whatever I please. You will keep other people out of it, she screamed, so loudly that the birds stopped chattering. She thrashed against him, gripping his wrists. No one else. Tell me why, Aelin. That goddamned name. She dug her nails into his wrists. Because I am sick of it. She was gulping down air, each breath shuddering as the horrific realization she'd been holding at bay since Nehemia's death came loose. I told her I would not help, so she orchestrated her own death. Because she thought... She laughed, a horrible, wild sound. She thought that her death would spur me into action. She thought I could somehow do more than her, that she was worth more dead. And she lied about everything. She lied to me because I was a coward, and I hate her for it. I hate her for leaving me. Rowan still pinned her, his warm blood dripping onto her face. She had said it, said the words she'd been choking on for weeks and weeks. The rage seeped from her like a wave pulling away from shore, and she let go of his wrists. Please, she panted, not caring that she was begging. Please, don't bring anyone else into it. I will do anything you ask of me, but that is my line.
anything else but that.
His eyes were veiled as he finally let go of her arms. She gazed up at the canopy. She would not cry in front of him. Not again. He peeled back, the space between them now a tangible thing.
How did she die?
She let the moisture against her back seep into her, cool her bones. She manipulated a mutual acquaintance into thinking he needed to kill her in order to further his agenda. He hired an assassin, made sure I wasn't around, and had her murdered. Oh, Nehemia. She had done it all out of a fool's hope, not realizing what a waste it was. She could have allied with flawless Galen Ashriver and saved the world, found a truly useful heir to the throne.
What happened to the two men?
A cold question. The assassin I hunted down and left in pieces in an alleyway. And the man who hired him. Blood on her hands, on her clothes, in her hair. Chaos' horrified stare. I gutted him and dumped his body in a sewer. They were two of the worst things she'd done, out of pure hatred and vengeance and rage. She waited for the lecture. But Rowan merely said,
"Good."
She was so surprised that she looked at him and saw what she had done. Not his already bruised and bleeding face, or his ripped jacket and shirt, now muddy. But right where she'd gripped his forearms, the clothes were burned through, the skin beneath covered in angry red welts. Handprints. She'd burned right through the tattoo on his left arm. She was on her feet in an instant, wondering if she should be on her knees begging for forgiveness instead. It must have hurt like hell. Yet he had taken it. The beating. The burning. While she let out those words that had clouded her senses for so many weeks now.
"I am so sorry," she started.
But he held up a hand.
"You do not apologize," he said, "for defending the people you care about."
She supposed it was as much of an apology as she would ever get from him. She nodded, and he took that as answer enough. "I'm keeping the sword," she said, yanking it free of the earth. She'd be hard-pressed to find a better one anywhere in the world.
"You haven't earned it."
He fell silent, then added,
"But consider this a favor. Leave it in your rooms when we're training."
She would have debated, but this was a compromise too. She wondered if he'd made a compromise any time in the last century. "What if that thing tracks us to the fortress once darkness falls?"
"Even if it does, it can't get past the wards."
When she raised her brows, he said,
"The stones around the fortress have a spell woven between them to keep out enemies. Even magic bounces off it."
"Oh."
"Well, that explained why they called it Mistward."
A calm, if not pleasant, silence fell between them while they walked.
"You know," she said slyly,
"that's twice now you've made a mess of my training with your tasks. I'm fairly sure that makes you the worst instructor I've ever had."
He gave her a sidelong look. "I'm surprised it took you this long to call attention to it."
She snorted, and as they approached the fortress, the torches and candles ignited, as if to welcome them home.
"I've never seen such a sorry sight," Emrys hissed,
as Rowan and Selena trudged into the kitchen.
"Blood and dirt and leaves over every inch of you both."
Indeed, they were something to behold, both their faces swollen and lacerated, covered in each other's blood, hair a mess, and Selena limping slightly.
The knuckles of her two fingers were split, and her knee throbbed from an injury she did not recall getting.
No better than alley cats brawling at all hours of the day and night, Emrys said, slamming two bowls of stew onto the work table. Eat, both of you, and then get cleaned up. Alentia, you're off kitchen duty tonight and tomorrow.
Selena opened her mouth to object, but the old man held up a hand.
I don't want you bleeding on everything. You'll be more trouble than you're worth.
Wincing, Selena slumped next to Rowan on the bench and swore viciously at the pain in her leg, her face, her arms. Swore at the pain in the ass sitting right next to her.
Clean your mouth out, too, while you're at it,
Emrys snapped. Luca was huddled by the fire, wide-eyed and making a sharp, cutting gesture across his neck, as if to warn Selena about something. Even Malachi, seated at the other end of the table with two weathered sentries, was watching her with raised brows. Rowan was already hunched over the table, digging into his stew. She glanced again at Luca, who frantically tapped his ears. She hadn't shifted back. And, well, now they'd all noticed, even with the blood and dirt and leaves. Malachi met her stare, and she dared him, just dared the old man to say anything. But he shrugged and went back to his meal. So it really wasn't a surprise after all. She took a bite of her stew and had to bite back her moan. Was it her fey senses, or was it even more delicious tonight? Emrys was watching from the hearth, and Selena gave him that challenging look, too. She punched back through the veil, aching as she shifted into her mortal form. But the old man brought her and Rowan a loaf of bread and said,
Makes no difference to me whether your ears are pointy or round, or what your teeth look like. But,
he added, looking at Rowan,
I can't deny I'm glad to see you got in a few punches this time.
Rowan's head snapped up from his bowl, and Emrys pointed a spoon at him.
Don't you think you've had enough of beating each other into a pulp?
Malachi stiffened, but Emrys went on.
What good does it accomplish, other than providing me with a scullery maid whose face scares the wits out of our sentries? You think any of us like to hear you two cursing and screaming every afternoon? The language you use is enough to curdle all the milk in Wendlin.
Rowan lowered his head and mumbled something into his stew. For the first time in a long, long while, Selena felt the corners of her lips tug up. And that was when Selena walked to the old man and got onto her knees. She apologized profusely. To Emrys, to Luca, to Malachi. Apologized because they deserved it. They accepted, but Emrys still looked wary. Hurt, even. The shame of what she'd said to that man, to all of them, would cling to her for a while. Though it made her stomach twist and palms sweat, though they didn't mention names, she wasn't all that surprised when Emrys told her that he and the other old fae knew who she was and that her mother had worked to help them. But she was surprised when Rowan took a spot at the sink and helped clean up after the evening meal. They worked in an easy silence. There were still truths she hadn't confessed to, stains on her soul she couldn't yet explore or express. But maybe he wouldn't walk away whenever she did find the courage to tell him. At the table, Luca was grinning with delight. Just seeing that smile, that bit of proof that today's events hadn't scarred him completely, made Selena look at Emrys and say, We had an adventure today. Malachi set down his spoon and said,
Let me guess. It had something to do with that roar that sent the livestock into pandemonium.
Though Selena didn't smile, her eyes crinkled. What do you know of a creature that dwells in the lake under? She glanced at Rowan to finish.
Bald Mountain. And he can't know that story, Rowan said. No one does.
I am a story keeper, Emrys said, staring down at him with all the wrath of one of the iron figurines on the mantle. And that means that the tales I collect might not come from fae or human mouths, but I hear them anyway.
He sat down at the table, folding his hands in front of him.
I heard one story, years ago, from a fool who thought he could cross the Cambrian Mountains and enter Maeve's realm without invitation. He was on his way back, barely clinging to life thanks to Maeve's wild wolves in the passes, so we brought him here while we sent for the healers.
Malachi murmured, "So that's why you wouldn't give him a moment's peace." A twinkle in those old eyes, and Emrys gave his mate a wry smile.
He had a fierce infection, so at the time I thought it might have been a fever dream. But he told me he found a cave at the base of the Bald Mountain. He camped there, because it was raining and cold, and he planned to be off at first light. Still, he felt like something was watching him from the lake. He drifted off, and awoke only because the ripples were lapping against the shore. Ripples from the center of the lake. And just beyond the light of his fire, out in the deep, he spied something swimming, bigger than a tree or any beast he'd ever seen.
Oh, it was horrific, Luca cut in. You said you were out with Bass and the other scouts on border patrol today, Emrys barked, then gave Rowan a look that suggested he'd better test his next meal for poison. Emrys cleared his throat and was soon staring at the table again, lost in thought.
What the fool learned that night was this. The creature was almost as old as the mountain itself. It claimed to have been born in another world, but had slipped into this one when the gods were looking elsewhere. It had preyed upon fae and humans until a mighty fae warrior challenged it. And before the warrior was through, he carved one of the creature's eyes out, for spite or sport, and cursed the beast, so that as long as that mountain stood, the creature would be forced to live beneath it. A monster from another realm. Had it been let in during the Volg Wars, when demons had opened and closed portals to another world at will? How many of the horrific creatures that dwelled in this land were only here because of those long-ago battles over the word keys? So it has dwelled in the labyrinth of underwater caves under the mountain. It has no name, for it forgot what it was called long ago. And those who meet it do not return home.
Selena rubbed her arms, wincing as the split skin of her knuckles stretched with the movement. Rowan was staring directly at Emrys, his head cocked ever so slightly to the side. Rowan glanced at her, as if to make sure she was listening, and asked,
"Who was the warrior who carved out its eye?" The fool didn't know, and neither did the beast, but the language it spoke was fae, an archaic form of the old language, almost indecipherable. It could remember the gold ring he bore, but not what he looked like.
It took every ounce of effort not to grab for her pocket and the ring she'd put in there, or to examine the sword she'd left by the door, and the ruby that might not be a ruby after all. But it was impossible. Too much of a coincidence. She might have given in to the urge to look, had Rowan not reached for his glass of water.
He hid it well, and she didn't think anyone else noticed. But as the sleeve of his jacket shifted, he winced, ever so slightly, from the burns she'd given him. They'd been blistering earlier. They must be screaming in agony now.
Emrys pinned the prince with a stare.
No more adventures.
Rowan glanced at Luca, who seemed about to explode with indignation.
Agreed.
Emrys didn't back down,
and no more brawling.
Rowan met Selena's stare over the table. His expression yielded nothing.
We'll try.
Even Emrys deemed that an acceptable answer. Despite the exhaustion that slammed into her like a wall, Selena couldn't sleep. She kept thinking of the creature, of the sword and the ring she'd examined for an hour without learning anything, and the control, however shaky, she'd managed to have on the ice. Yet she kept circling back to what she'd done to Rowan, how badly she'd burned him. His pain tolerance must be tremendous, she thought, as she twisted on her cot, huddled against the cold in the room. She eyed her tin of salve. He should have gone to a healer for those burns. She tossed and turned for another 5 minutes before she yanked on her boots, grabbed the tin, and left. She'd probably get her head bitten off again, but she wouldn't get a wink of sleep if she were too busy feeling guilty. Gods, she felt guilty. She knocked softly on his door, half hoping he wasn't there. But he snapped, "What?" And she winced and went in. His room was toasty and warm, if not a little old and shabby, especially the worn rugs thrown over much of the gray stone floor. A large four-poster bed occupied much of the space, a bed that was still made and empty. Rowan was seated at the work table in front of the carved fireplace, shirtless and examining what looked to be a map marked with the locations of those bodies. His eyes flashed with annoyance, but she ignored him as she studied the massive tattoo that went from his face down his neck and shoulders and covered the entirety of his left arm, straight to his fingertips. She hadn't really looked that day in the woods, but now she marveled at its beautiful, unbroken lines, save for the manacle-like burn around his wrist. Both wrists.
What do you want?
She hadn't inspected his body too closely before, either. His chest, tan enough to suggest he spent a good amount of time without a shirt, was sculpted with muscle and covered in thick scars. From fights or battles or the gods knew what. A warrior's body that he'd had centuries to hone. She tossed the salve to him. I thought you might want this. He caught it with one hand, but his eyes remained on her.
I deserved it.
Doesn't mean I can't feel bad. He turned the tin over and over between his fingers. There was a particularly long and nasty scar down his right pectoral. Where had it come from?
Is this a bribe?
Give it back if you're going to be a pain in my ass. She held out her hand. But he closed his fingers around the tin, then set it on his work table. He said,
You could heal yourself, you know. Heal me, too. Nothing major, but you have that gift.
She knew, sort of. Her magic had sometimes healed her injuries without conscious thought. It's the drop of water affinity I inherited from Mab's line. The fire had been the gift of her father's bloodline. My mother. The words made her sick, but she said them for some reason. Told me that the drop of water in my magic was my salvation and sense of self-preservation. A nod from him, and she admitted, I wanted to learn to use it like the other healers. Long ago, I mean. But was never allowed to. They said, well, it wouldn't be all that useful since I didn't have much of it, and queens don't become healers. She should stop talking. For some reason, her stomach dropped as he said,
Go to bed. Since you're banned from the kitchen tomorrow, we're training at dawn.
Well, she certainly deserved the dismissal after burning him like that.
So she turned. And maybe she looked as pathetic as she felt. Because he suddenly said,
"Wait. Shut the door."
She obeyed. He didn't give her leave to sit, so she leaned against the wooden door and waited. He kept his back to her, and she watched the powerful muscles expand and contract as he took a deep breath. Then another. Then,
"When my mate died, it took me a very, very long time to come back."
It took her a moment to think of what to say. How long ago?
203 years, 27 days ago.
He gestured to the tattoo on his face, neck, arms.
"This tells the story of how it happened. Of the shame I'll carry until my last breath."
The warrior who had come the other day had such hollow eyes. "Others come to you to have their own grief and shame tattooed on them."
"Gavriel lost 3 of his soldiers in an ambush in the southern mountains. They were slaughtered. He survived. For as long as he's been a warrior, he's tattooed himself with the names of those under his command who have fallen. But where the blame lies has little to do with the point of the markings."
"Were you to blame?" Slowly, he turned. Not quite all the way, but enough to give her a sidelong glance.
"Yes. When I was young, I was ferocious in my efforts to win valor for myself and my bloodline. Wherever Maeve sent me on campaigns, I went. Along the way, I made it a female of our race.
Lyria," he said, almost reverently.
"She sold flowers in the market in Doranel. Maeve disapproved, but when you meet your mate, there is nothing you can do to alter it. She was mine, and no one could tell me otherwise. Mating her cost me Maeve's favor, and I still yearned so badly to prove myself. So when war came calling and Maeve offered me a chance to redeem myself, I took it. Lyria begged me not to go, but I was so arrogant, so misguided, that I left her at our mountain home and went off to war. I left her alone,"
he said, and again looked at Selena. "You left me," she had said to him. That was when he'd snapped, the wounds of centuries ago rising up to swallow him as viciously as her own past consumed her.
"I was gone for months, winning all that glory I so foolishly sought. And then we got word that our enemies had been secretly trying to gain entrance to Doranel through the mountain passes."
Her stomach dropped to her feet. Rowan ran a hand through his hair, scratched at his face.
"I flew home, as fast as I'd ever flown. When I got there, I found that found she had been with child. And they had slaughtered her anyway, and burnt our house to cinders. When you lose a mate, you don't—"
A shake of the head.
"I lost all sense of self, of time and place. I hunted them down, all the males who hurt her. I took a long while killing them. She was pregnant. Had been pregnant since I'd left her, but I'd been so enamored with my own foolish agenda that I hadn't scented it on her. I left my pregnant mate alone."
Her voice broke, but she managed to say, "What did you do after you killed them?" His face was stark, and his eyes focused on some far-off sight.
"For 10 years, I did nothing. I vanished. I went mad. Beyond mad. I felt nothing at all. I just left. I wandered the world, in and out of my forms, hardly marking the seasons, eating only when my hawk told me it needed to feed or it would die. I would have let myself die, except I Couldn't bring myself.
He trailed off and cleared his throat.
I might have stayed that way forever, but Maeve tracked me down. She said it was enough time spent in mourning, and that I was to serve her as prince and commander, to work with a handful of other warriors to protect the realm. It was the first time I had spoken to anyone since that day I found Lyria. The first time I'd heard my name, or remembered it.
So you went with her?
I had nothing. No one. At that point, I hoped serving her might get me killed, and then I could see Lyria again. So when I returned to Doranau, I wrote the story of my shame on my flesh, and then I bound myself to Maeve with the blood oath, and have served her since.
How did you come back from that kind of loss?
I didn't. For a long while, I couldn't. I think I'm still not back. I might never be.
She nodded, lips pressed tight, and glanced toward the window.
But maybe,
he said, quietly enough that she looked at him again. He didn't smile, but his eyes were inquisitive.
Maybe we could find the way back together.
He would not apologize for today or yesterday or for any of it, and she would not ask him to. Not now that she understood that in the weeks she had been looking at him, it had been like gazing at a reflection. No wonder she had loathed him.
I think,
she said, barely more than a whisper.
I would like that very much.
He held out a hand.
Together, then.
She studied the scarred, calloused palm, then the tattooed face, full of a grim sort of hope. Someone who might, who did understand what it was like to be crippled at your very core. Someone who was still climbing inch by inch out of that abyss. Perhaps they would never get out of it. Perhaps they would never be whole again, but together, she said, and took his outstretched hand. And somewhere far and deep inside her, an ember began to glow. Part 2. Heir of Fire. Chapter 36.
Things are ready for your meeting tonight with Captain Westfall?
Adian could have sworn Ren Alsbrook bristled as he bit out the name. Seated beside the young lord on the ledge of the roof of the warehouse apartment, Adian considered Ren's tone, decided it wasn't enough of a challenge to warrant a verbal slap, and gave a nod as he went back to cleaning his nails with one of his fighting knives. Ren had been recovering for days now, after the captain had set him up in the guest room of the apartment. The old man had refused to take the main bedroom, saying he'd prefer the couch. But Adian wondered what exactly Murtagh had observed when they arrived in the apartment. If he suspected who the owner was, Selena or Aelin or both, he revealed nothing. Adian hadn't seen Ren since the opium den, and he didn't really know why he'd bothered to come tonight. He said,
You've managed to build yourself a network of lowlifes here. That's a far cry from the lofty towers of Alsbrook Castle.
Ren's jaw tightened.
You're a far cry from the White Towers of Orinth, too. We all are.
A breeze ruffled Ren's shaggy hair.
Thank you for helping that night.
It was nothing, Adian said coolly, giving him a lazy smile.
You killed for me, then hit me. That isn't nothing. I owe you.
Adian was plenty used to accepting gratitude from other men. From his men.
But this...
You should have told me,
he said, dropping the grin as he watched the golden lights twinkling across the city.
That you and your grandfather had no home.
Or money. No wonder Ren's clothes were so shabby. The shame Adian had felt that night had almost overwhelmed him, and had haunted him for the past few days, honing his temper to a near-lethal edge. He'd tried working it off with the castle guards, but sparring with the men who protected the king had only sharpened it.
I don't see how it's relevant to anything,
Ren said tightly. Adian could understand pride. The kind Ren had went deep, and admitting this vulnerability was as hard for him as it was for Adian to accept Ren's gratitude. Ren said,
If you find out how to break the spell on magic, you're going to do it, right?
Yes. It could make a difference in whatever battles lie ahead.
It didn't make a difference 10 years ago.
Ren's face was a mask of ice. And then Adian remembered. Ren hardly had a drop of magic, but Ren's two elder sisters. The girls had been away at their mountain school when everything went to hell. A school for magic. As if reading his thoughts, as if this were a reprieve from the city below them, Ren said,
When the soldiers dragged us to the butchering blocks, that was what they mocked my parents about. Because even with their magic, my sister's school was defenseless. They could do nothing against 10,000 soldiers.
I'm sorry,
Adian said. That was all he could offer for the time being, until Aelin returned. Ren looked right at him.
Going back to Terrasen will be hard for me and for my grandfather.
He seemed to struggle with the words, or just with the idea of telling anyone anything. But Adian gave him the time he needed. At last Ren said,
I'm not sure I'm civilized enough anymore. I don't know if I could be a lord, even. If my people would want me as lord. My grandfather is better suited, but he's an Alsbrook by marriage, and he says he doesn't want to rule.
Ah. Adian found himself actually pausing. Contemplating. The wrong word, the wrong reaction, could make Ren shut up forever. It shouldn't matter. But it did. So he said,
My life has been war and death for the past 10 years. It will probably be war and death for the next few as well. But if there's ever a day when we find peace...
God's that word. That beautiful word.
It'll be a strange transition for all of us. For whatever it's worth... I don't see how the people of Alsbrook wouldn't embrace a lord who spent years trying to break Otterlin's rule. Or a lord who spent years in poverty for that dream.
I've done things, Ren said.
Bad things.
Adian had suspected as much from the moment Ren gave them the address of the opium den.
So have we all. Adian said. So has Aelin.
He wanted to say it, but he still didn't want Ren or Murtaug or anyone knowing a damn thing about her. It was her story to tell. Adian knew the conversation was about to take a turn for the ugly when Ren tensed and asked too quietly,
What do you plan to do about Captain Westfall?
Right now, Captain Westfall is useful to me, and useful to our queen.
So, as soon as he's outlived his usefulness?
I'll decide that when the time comes, if it's safe to leave him alive.
Ren opened his mouth, but Adian added,
This is the way it has to be, the way I operate.
Even if he'd helped save Ren's life and given him a place to stay.
I wonder what our queen will think of the way you operate.
Adian flashed him a glare that had sent men running. But he knew Ren wasn't particularly scared of him, not with what he had seen and endured. Not after Adian had killed for him. Adian said, "If she's smart, then she'll let me do what needs to be done. She'll use me as the weapon I am."
"What if she wishes to be your friend? Would you deny her that, too?"
"I will deny her nothing."
"And if she asks you to be her king?"
Adian bared his teeth. "Enough."
"Do you want to be king?"
Adian swung his legs back onto the roof and stood. "All I want," he snarled, "is for my people to be free and my queen restored to her throne."
"They burned the antler throne, Adian. There is no throne for her."
"Then I'll build one myself from the bones of our enemies."
Ren winced as he stood as well, his injuries no doubt bothering him, and kept his distance. He might not be afraid, but he wasn't stupid.
"Answer the question. Do you want to be king?"
"If she asked me, I would not refuse her."
It was the truth. "That's not an answer."
He knew why Ren had asked. Even Adian was aware that he could be king. With his legion and ties to the Ash Rivers, he'd be an advantageous match. A warrior king would make any foes think twice. Even before their kingdom shattered, he'd heard the rumors.
"My only wish," Adian said, growling in Ren's face, "is to see her again. Just once, if that's all the gods will allow me. If they grant me more time than that, then I'll thank them every damn day of my life. But for now, all I'm working for is to see her, to know for certain that she's real, that she survived. The rest is none of your concern."
He felt Ren's eyes on him as he vanished through the door to the apartment below. The tavern was packed with soldiers on rotation home to Otterlin, the heat and reek of bodies making Kaol wish Adian had done this alone. There was no hiding now that he and Adian were drinking friends, as the general trumpeted for everyone to hear while the soldiers cheered.
"Better to hide it right under everyone's nose than pretend, eh?"
Adian murmured to Kaol, as yet another free drink was slapped down on their stained, sodden table, courtesy of a soldier who had bowed, actually bowed, to Adian.
"For the wolf,"
said the scarred and tan-skinned soldier, before returning to his packed table of comrades. Adian saluted the man with the mug, getting a cheer in response, and there was nothing faked about his feral grin. It hadn't taken Adian long to find the soldiers Murtaugh thought they should question. Soldiers who had been stationed at one of the suspected spell origin points. While Adian had been searching for the right group of men, Kaol had taken the time to go about his own duties, which now included considering a candidate to replace him, and packing for his return to Aniel. He'd come into Rifthold today with the excuse of finding a company to ship his first trunk of belongings, a task he'd actually accomplished. He didn't want to think of what his mother would do when the trunk of books arrived at the keep. Kaol didn't bother looking pleasant as he said,
"Get on with it."
Adian stood, hoisting his mug. As though they'd all been watching him, the room quieted.
"Soldiers,"
he said, loud and soft at once, grave and reverent. He turned in place, mug still upheld.
"For your blood, for your scars, for every dent in your shield and nick in your sword, for every friend and foe dead before you."
The mug raised higher, and Adian bowed his head, golden hair gleaming in the light.
"For what you have given and have yet to give, I salute you.
for a heartbeat, as the room thundered with roars and cries, Kaol beheld what truly made Adian a threat, what made him a god to these men, and why the king tolerated his insolence, ring or no ring. Adian was not a noble in a castle sipping wine. He was metal and sweat, sitting in this filthy tavern drinking their ale. Whether it was real or not, they believed he cared about them, listened to them. They preened when he remembered their names, their wives' and sisters' names, and slept assured that he saw them as his brothers. Adian made sure that they believed he would fight and die for them. Thus they would fight and die for him. And Kaol was afraid, but not for himself. He was afraid of what would come when Adian and Aelin were reunited. For he'd seen in her that same glittering ember that made people look and listen. Had seen her stalk into a council meeting with Counselor Mollison's head and smile at the King of Otterlin. Every man in that room enthralled and petrified by the dark whirlwind of her spirit. The two of them together, both of them lethal, working hard to build an army, to ignite their people. He was afraid of what they would do to his kingdom. Because this was still his kingdom. He was working for Dorian, not Aelin, not Adian. And he didn't know where all of this put him.
A contest, Adian called, standing on the bench.
Kaol hadn't moved during the long, long hour Adian had been saluted and toasted by half the men in this room, each one getting a turn to stand and tell his story to the general. When Adian had enough of being serenaded by his own enemy, his Ash River eyes brilliant with a rush that Kaol knew was precisely because he hated each and every one of them, and they were eating out of his palm like rabbits, the general roared for the contest. There were a few shouted suggestions for drinking games, but Adian hoisted his mug again, and silence fell.
Farthest to travel drinks for free.
There were cries of Benjali, Orinth, Melisande, Aniel, and Dovier, but then...
Quiet, all of you.
An older gray-haired soldier stood.
I got you all beat.
He lifted his glass to the general and pulled a scroll from his vest. Release papers.
I just spent 5 years at Knoll.
Bullseye. Adian thumped the empty seat at the table.
Then you drink with us, my friend.
The room cheered again. Knoll. It was a speck on the map at the farthest end of the deserted peninsula. The man sat down, and before Adian could raise a finger to the barkeep, a fresh pint was before the stranger.
Knoll, eh? Adian said. Commander Jensen of the 24th Legion, sir. How many men were under you, Commander? 2,000, all of us sent back here last month.
Jensen took a long drink.
5 years, and we're done just like that.
He snapped his scarred, thick fingers.
I take it His Majesty didn't give you any warning. With all due respect, General, he didn't tell us shit. I got the word that we were to move out because new forces were coming in, and we weren't needed anymore.
Kaol kept his mouth shut, listening, as Adian had told him to do.
What for? Is he sending you to join another legion? No word yet. Didn't even tell us who was taking our place.
Adian grinned.
At least you're not in Knoll anymore.
Jensen looked into his drink, but not before Kaol caught the shadow in the man's eyes.
What was it like? Off the record, of course,
Adian said. Jensen's smile had faded, and when he looked up, there was no light in his eyes.
The volcanoes are active, so it's always dark, you see, because the ash covers everything.
and because of the fumes, we always had headaches. Sometimes men went mad from them. Sometimes we got nosebleeds from them, too. We got our food once a month. Occasionally less than that, depending on the season and when the ships could bring in supplies. The locals wouldn't make the trek across the sands, no matter how much we threatened and bribed them.
Why? Laziness?
Noel isn't much, just the tower in town we built around it. But the volcanoes were sacred. And 10 years ago, maybe a bit longer, apparently we, not my men because I wasn't there, but rumor says the king took a legion into those volcanoes and sacked the temple.
Jensen shook his head.
The locals spit on us. Even the men who weren't there for that. The tower and knoll was built afterward, and then the locals cursed it too. So it was always just us.
A tower?
Kael said quietly, and Adian frowned at him. Jensen drank deeply.
Not that we were ever allowed in.
The men who went mad, Adian said, a half smile on his face.
What did they do exactly?
The shadows were back, and Jensen glanced around him. Not to see who was listening, but almost as if he wanted to find a way out of this conversation. But then he looked at the general and said,
"Our reports say, General, that we killed him. Arrows to the throat, quick and clean. But..."
Adian leaned closer.
"Not a word leaves this table."
A vague nod.
"The truth was, by the time we got our archers ready, the men who went mad had already bashed their own skulls in. Every time. As if they couldn't get the pain out."
Selena claimed Kaltain and Roland had complained about headaches, as a result of the king's magic being used on them, his horrible power. And she had told him she got a pounding headache when she uncovered those secret dungeons beneath the castle. Dungeons that led to...
"The tower. You were never allowed in?"
Kael ignored Adian's warning glare.
"There was no door. Always seemed more decorative than anything. But I hated it. We all did. It was just this awful black stone."
Just like the clock tower in the glass castle. Built around the same time, if not a few years before.
"Why bother?" Adian drawled. "A waste of resources, if you ask me."
There were still so many shadows in the man's eyes, full of stories that Kael didn't dare ask about. The commander drained his glass and stood.
"I don't know why they bothered. With Noel or Amaroth. We'd sometimes send men up and down the Western Sea with messages between the towers, so we knew they had a similar one. We didn't even really know what the hell we were all doing out there anyway. There was no one to fight."
Amaroth. The other outpost. And Murtaugh's other possible origin point for their spell. Due north from Noel. Both the same distance from Rifthold. 3 towers of black stone, all 3 points making an equilateral triangle. It had to be part of the spell, then. Kael traced the rim of his glass. He had sworn to keep Dorian out of it, to leave him alone. He had no way of testing out any theory, and didn't want to get within 10 feet of that clock tower. But perhaps the theory could be tested on a small scale, just to see if they were right about what the king had done. Which meant he needed Dorian. Chapter 37. It was 2 weeks of training for Manon and her 13. 2 weeks of waking up before the sun to fly each canyon run, to master it as one unit.
2 weeks of scratches and sprained limbs, of near deaths from falls or the wyverns squabbling or just stupid miscalculation. But slowly, they developed instincts, not just fighting as a unit, but as individual riders and mounts. Manon didn't like the thought of the mounts eating the foul-tasting meat raised within the mountain. So twice a day they hunted the mountain goats, swooping to pluck them off the mountainsides. It wasn't long before the witches started eating the goats themselves, building hasty fires in the mountain passes to cook their breakfast and evening meals. Manon didn't want any of them, mounts or riders, taking another bite of the food given to them by the king's men, or tasting the men themselves. If it smelled and tasted strange, odds were something was wrong with it. She didn't know if it was the fresh meat or the extra lessons, but the 13 were starting to outpace every coven, to the point where Manon ordered the 13 to hold back whenever the yellow legs gathered to watch their lessons. Abraxos was still a problem. She hadn't dared take the crossing with him, as his wings, while slightly stronger, weren't better by much. At least not enough to brave the sheer plunge through the narrow pass. Manon had been chewing it over every night when the 13 gathered in her room to compare notes about flying, their iron nails glinting as they used their hands to demonstrate the ways they'd taught their wyverns to bank, to take off, to do some fancy maneuver. For all the excitement, they were exhausted. Even the lofty-headed bluebloods had their tempers on tight leashes, and Manon had been called in a dozen times now to break apart brawls. Manon used her downtime to see Abraxos, to check on his iron claws and teeth, to take him out for extra rides when everyone else had passed out in their cots. He needed as much training as he could get, and she liked the quiet and stillness of the night, with the silvered mountain peaks and the river of stars above, even if it made waking up the next day difficult. So after braving the wrath of her grandmother, Manon won 2 days off for the Blackbeaks, convincing her that if they didn't rest, there would be outright war in the middle of the mess hall, and the king wouldn't have an aerial cavalry left to ride his wyverns into battle. They got 2 days to sleep and eat, and to see whatever needs only the men across the mountain could provide. That was something a good number of the 13 were doing, as she'd seen Vesta, Lynn, Asterin, and the demon twins stalking across the bridge. No sleeping for Manon today or tomorrow. No eating. Or bedding men. No. She was taking Abraxos out into the ruins. He was already saddled, and Manon ensured Windcleaver was tightly strapped to her back as she mounted him. The saddlebags were an unexpected weight behind her, and she made a note to start training the 13 and the rest of the covens with them. If they were to be an army, then they'd carry their supplies, as most soldiers did. And training with weights would make them faster when it came time to fly without them.
"You sure I can't convince you not to go?"
the overseer said, as she paused at the back gates.
"You know the stories as well as I do. This won't come without a cost."
"His wings are weak, and so far everything else we've tried to reinforce them